challenge you and have you challenge me and have us try to make some sense out of the world rather than, you know, just kind of following orders or accepting everything that comes down the pike. Anyways, this is, well, I should probably tell you who it is. It's Karine Verschata, I think it is, from, boy, I can't even make out the town. Maria Kirka, Belgium. Says he's a collector of autographs, or is Karine a woman? I don't know. I'm a collector of autographs of politicians, sportsmen, artists, and authors from around the world. I would like to ask you if you'd be so kind to send me an autograph of you. Thank you very much. May God bless you and your family. With warm greetings from Belgium, and of course, I wish you all the best in your career. So, normally I don't do it, but I got a little, somewhere or other, I have some WRIF photos. And why am I saying this? I'm not sending them out to anybody else. Don't even ask. Anyways, 313-298-WRIF. Used to do a lot of what we call personal appearances, the auto show, or just go to bars, or there'd be an opening at a gas station. You know, rock DJs do that all the time. So we'd have these photo cards, and what did I used to write on it? Oh, yeah, rock on. That's how I used to put it. Rock on. You know, Peter Werby. Anyways, if you want to email me, calltalkyes@yahoo.com. That'll get my attention. Short messages may possibly get read on the air. It's a talk show, though, so 313-298-WRIF. And there's so much to talk about. I just got off the phone with Barry Crimmins. Barry Crimmins is a humorist, a political satirist. He's a writer for Air America's Randy Rhodes Show. This is a nationally syndicated talk show on a liberal talk network. And also, he's the author of Never Shake Hands with a War Criminal. I love it. He is right now in Crawford, Texas. He's at Camp Casey. That's where Cindy Sheehan. Cindy Sheehan is the mother of Casey Sheehan, who was killed in Iraq. He was a father of twin children. And she wants some answers from George Bush. If you're just joining the show, you'll never hear me call him President Bush, because I believe that George Bush and the Republicans stole two elections in a row, 2000 and 2004. But that's maybe talk for another time. Although, hey, you know, the complaint department, as we say, is always open, 313-298-WRIF. Anyways, we're going to try to get Barry on the line at about 11:30 Eastern time. That's in about a half an hour. And coming in, you know, usually, other than a few weird shows like mine, the airwaves are besotted with right-wing talk show hosts everywhere. I'm just going to click, you know, Cindy Sheehan, Cindy Sheehan. So here's this mom, and just grief-stricken, this feeling, this intense sense that her son died for absolutely nothing in Iraq, and she wants some answers from George W. Bush, and he's not forthcoming. But as a matter of fact, of all the righties that have been trash-talking her, Bush is one of the few people that has said anything decent. He said she's got a right to say what she wants, got the right to be where she is outside of his ranch in Crawford at their makeshift Camp Casey. But all the others, all these other creatures of the right, they're just talking so bad about her. And all it does, of course, in a period like this, when the right wing, when all the lies that they've perpetrated over the last 5 years are beginning to crash in on them, they're way on the defensive. So people are, they never heard of Cindy Sheehan. Then suddenly they'll hear this right-wing talk show host and this right-wing talker on television saying that she's this, she's that. I'm surprised. They're going to get into her sex life. Believe it. They're going to be talking about Cindy Sheehan's sex life when she was 17. That's coming soon. Well, we'll be talking about that a little later. But if you have any observations about Cindy Sheehan's vigil? In fact, in the New York Times the other day, August 12th, mother's grief-fueled vigil becomes nexus for anti-war protesters. Wow. So a lot of, you know, not a tremendous number, but quite a few people who feel strongly in opposing the war are going down to Crawford, Texas. Hey, isn't Ted Nugent living there now? What's he up to? I wonder what his deal on this is. Didn't he move there to be near Bush? How weird is that? Bush is there. What is he? 5 weeks this time. It frightens me when he goes on vacation. I remember what happened in August of 2001 when he went on vacation. Didn't pay attention to stuff. He read a few memos. Osama bin Laden will strike in the U.S. Oh, yeah, all right. Well, I'm going to go cut some brush, something like that. There were supposed to be some anti-Cindy Sheehan demonstrations, but someone said to me, you know, this is just the, all of a sudden, Terry Schiavo, I couldn't think of it for a second, Terry Schiavo of the left situation. Remember that in Florida, that all these whacked out religious freaks went down there to and started calling her Terry. And then, of course, as it came out after the autopsy, she was as injured and as damaged a person as her husband Michael had said. And they were just using this. Now you're hearing some similarities here, so you can get on the phone at 313-298-WRIF. They were just using this horrible situation that this family in Florida found themselves in for their own political and religious agenda. It backfired on them big time. The Cindy Sheehan situation is having the opposite. It's expanding the anti-war sentiment that's sweeping this country. Nobody except far-right wingers and people that aren't paying attention are still supporting this war and Bush's handling of it. It goes from bad to worse each day. 70 attacks a day. 6 more Marines killed. I don't know if they're Marines. 6 more U.S. service people killed again. Now, what's the difference here? The difference is all of that insane religious hoopla that went around Terry Schiavo was about one person. And it's not to say that these questions about life and death and the intervention of technology and medical technology and how do we determine what's life and what's death and all that aren't real important. But the people there, I mean, they were horrid. They intervened in the private, the private dealings of a family, a grief-stricken family. The mother and father of Terry Schiavo and the husband, many other people. In this case, pardon me, this is something that affects not just tens of thousands of servicemen, hundreds of thousands of service people, but, of course, millions of Iraqis. It affects all of us in terms of moral capital, ethical capital are we expending poorly, in fact, terribly. Over there, as this slaughter continues, this destruction continues, the individuals suffering intense tragedy. Cindy Sheehan, just one of now over 1,800 families with probably 13,000 severe injuries resulting. Tens of thousands of Iraqis dead. So this is of intense national concern. And I think we owe a real debt of gratitude to Cindy Sheehan for bringing this up in the manner that she did. I mean, people say, oh, you know, that was one of the things. Oh, she's getting a lot out of this. Yeah, well, yeah, let's lose our son, and let's go down and camp out in the hot sun and have all these right-wingers saying the most awful things in the world. Well, I drove by my local gas station. It cost me $34 to fill up, and I don't have I don't know what do you call these things? Regular size car. There's a word for it. Standard sedan. That's what I have. And so it says many fear financial hit of gas prices. So 2/3 of us think that, according to this AP poll, that these fuel costs are going to cause us financial hardship in the coming months. Do you think? Who are the third that don't? I mean, maybe the rich or something like that. But let's see, it was more than $2.40 a gallon. I saw it at $2.59, and on my website, peterwerbe.com, PETERWERBE.com, you can see in California, $3.09. So the people that are profiting grandly from this, like ExxonMobil, who have had some of the largest profits in their history in the last quarters, it's not like as the price of crude goes up, they have to raise their prices accordingly. Their profits are way above what the price of crude is, which is what now over $60 a barrel. And I always have this vision of the people that control things say, all right, it was a few years ago. What was it under Clinton? Wasn't it something like $1.42? And they say, all right, we got our boy in office. He's swam in oil all his life. He's from Texas. And, he didn't do real well in the oil business, but daddy bailed him out and all that. But, he's sympathetic. So let's crank this up. Let's see what happens. $1.75. Grumble, grumble, grumble. Little grumble. They didn't do anything. They didn't even say anything. Just put it up to $2. Hey, people started calling talk shows and talking to their neighbor. $2. Can you believe that? I remember when it was 29 cents a gallon. Stuff like that. You hear a lot of that from old timers. But still, no consequence. Not like in France or Italy or places like that where truck drivers will block the roads. You trying to charge us a lot for our gas, which is cutting substantially into our income? We're blocking the streets. So then crank it up a little more. So now they got up like 2.25, 2.35, 2.45, and in the West, it's over $3. So what'll happen? Here's what I predict will happen. It'll get up to around 3.50 or something like that. Yeah, or close to 3. And then someone, in some manner, will really throw a fit. The Congress will want to, pass some legislation to stop exorbitant profits by the oil companies, or maybe people will take direct action. Can you imagine that? And then they'll go, oh, okay, all right, we're going to put it down to 275. And everybody goes, oh, all right, we're getting gas for 275. That's what I think is going to happen. Where all this oil is sitting in the ground, not much of it coming out, is Iraq. I mean, that's why the United States invaded Iraq. We know now that everything about weapons of mass destruction was a lie. Anything about 9/11 was a lie. And so it doesn't leave much. Bush, somewhere in the stuff I have, is talking about how we're there to help the Iraqi people. Whew, man, don't come help me. Anyways, I'm not sure of this. you're not supposed to be on the air and say you're not sure yourself. But now, what this article says, despite crushing costs, Iraqi cabinet lets big subsidies stand. Now, if I am reading this right, the Iraqis are getting gasoline for like 3 cents a gallon. The country pays 30 to 35 cents a liter for the imported gasoline and sells it for a cent and a half. That's where the subsidy comes in. And there's 4 liters in a gallon. So that's six cents a gallon. 6 cents a gallon, sorry. So, and I Googled this. I tried to think, could this be? Could they really be getting gasoline for 6 cents a gallon? And this is all subsidized. So what's their income? Well, last year, the Iraqi budget was $21 billion. I know that doesn't amount to very much because they don't have much income. And this year, it's going to drop to $19 billion. And so who do you think is paying all of this money to make Iraq go? Building everything, paying everybody. You got it. Don't even say the United States government, because it's you and me. We're the taxpayers, and the United States government has zero money except when you and I give it to them. Now, we're willing to do it for police and fire, willing to do it for roads, we're willing to do it for schools, we're willing to do it for space exploration, we're willing to do it for garbage removal and all of that. That's why we have to pay taxes, or there wouldn't be any money to pay these folks that do all these services for us. And lots of other little odds and ends that make up life as we know it. However, there's also a little matter of $500 billion budget for the military, for the war budget every year. We don't have any enemies other than guys that often fight barefoot and use captured American weapons or old Kalashnikovs, right? But those are our only enemies, but we're spending more money than all the rest of the nations combined. Our big rival, maybe in the future, China spends 10% of that. So we are subsidizing the Iraqis who are getting gasoline for 6 cents a gallon when you and I are paying $2.50. Is there anything wrong here? Should we give Bush a big hand for this? That now we have to pay more and more of our income. And of course, the smaller your income, the more these increases affect what kind of money you have to spend on other stuff. Well, let's see. Maybe we could. Oh yeah, one thing. I misspoke myself. I mean, I said what I meant, and then I realized later that I misspoke myself. I said that when last week, when I was opening the show, and I was talking about the decision to bomb Pearl Harbor, and the decision to bomb Hiroshima and Nagasaki that began in Pearl Harbor with that kind of bombing and ended with a extraordinary atomic bombing of those two Japanese cities. And I said, it's really important not to accept received information or knowledge without a questioning spirit. And I said, you had to be cynical about, as far as I was concerned, this is my opinion. You can accept it all, although I think you wind up being fooled a lot if you do. And I said you had to have a healthy dose of cynicism. But later in the broadcast, when we were talking about these American soldiers, these National Guardsmen from California, that were running a mafia-style protection racket. Remember, we're over there to help them and free them. But these California Guardsmen, U.S. Reserves, or I'm sorry, there's a difference. So I don't know. I can't remember whether it was Reserves or the National Guard. They were demanding payment from Iraqi Baghdad merchants to go into a soldiers' fund. This is old-fashioned mafia extortion. And I said, I thought what was happening here, and I didn't bring this up because a lot of people say, I wish you wouldn't even bring that up. I mean, really puts our soldiers in a bad light. We want to support our troops. Why would he bring up, you know, the bad stuff? I mean, this is pretty embarrassing that a unit of the Guard or the Reserves winds up to be like a little mafia platoon extorting people in Baghdad. That can't operate unless these guys with guns get the money. And I said, it is their cynicism about the war they're in that leads to corruption. Cynicism leads to corruption. Because when you don't believe in something, when you know it's all a lie, when you know that, like during the Vietnam era, when people were singing the Country Joe song, Fixing to Die Rag, you know, the song about Vietnam, they were extraordinarily cynical over there. So what I meant was, not cynical, but skepticism. It's important to be skeptical always about official pronouncements. So unfortunately, I don't know, hopefully not a great number of you listening, because you listen to the show and you hear all of us talk and you're often one of the talkers, that you knew right from the beginning that Bush was lying. That you knew that Saddam had no weapons of mass destruction. You knew that there was no connection with 9-1-1. But this, if you believe that, you said, oh, the commander-in-chief said that. I saw it in the New York Times. I heard it on WJR radio here. Oh, this was the other. I guess it's all right. Nobody listens to that station anyway. I saw it on ABC News. Take it as an object lesson. And I am kind of saying, hey, I told you so. But what's the old expression? Once burned, twice shy. Once burned, twice shy. So if you believe Bush's lies, if you supported the march to war, if you ultimately, and I'm sorry to say this, has some ethical responsibility of everything that's happened since, don't do this again. Don't do this again. All right. Peter Werby here with you, 313-298-WRIF. We can talk about gas. We can talk about the war. Sooner or later, I want to talk about Costco, that store. You know, it's kind of like Sam's Club or something like that. But lots of other things to talk about as well. So let's see. Okay. Calling in from Detroit, it's Rick. Rick, hi. It's Peter Werby. You're on the air. Hey, Rick. Did I do it? No, Rick headed out. Maybe. Oh, wait a minute. Did I do that? No, that's how you do this. All right. Here's Clyde from Sterling Heights. Hi, Clyde. It's Peter Werby.
What's going on, Peter?
Just doing this radio show.
Cool.
What's up?
I just tuned in. I caught you talking about Cindy Sheenan.
Yeah.
Isn't it true that Bush met with her in 2004 and her entire family?
They met with her. Yeah, that's one of the things that's...
All right. So why does she feel it so strongly to meet with him again?
Well, I don't know. I mean, to be quite honest, I mean, the call is Bush meet with Cindy. But, you know, presidents usually don't meet with individual citizens because of, you know, they have a demand to do it. But many people, including Republicans, have said, hey, look, give her a private audience and get this off the front page of the papers because it's making us look terrible.
Well,
I mean, what could hurt by Bush saying, all right, we met once, we're going to meet again, because, you know, you feel a little differently than you did last time.
Well, when she met with him the first time, she wasn't being endorsed by all the leftist parties, which now she has all these left-wingers behind her.
Well, you know, this is part of the right-wing smear. The anti-war movement, Veterans for Peace, Iraqi veterans against the war, military families for common sense, citizen soldier, I mean, there's dozens of vet groups, for one thing, and there's also anti-war groups. And this is the whole right-wing deal to try to put this off on that she's a tool of the left. Well, I mean, her politics are, if you want to divide the country into left and right, of which I don't have a particular problem because I certainly consider myself on the left, she is a Democrat, so she was she's critical of the war. She was critical of the war all along.
Right, but her son volunteered like a year before he was shot, a year before we went to Iraq. So how's that Bush's fault when her son decided, I'm a man, I choose to enlist?
Well, because Bush sent people over there based on a set of lies.
Well, I'm not going to call them lies. But
well, what would you call them? I mean, if something isn't true and that people like myself and millions of other people around the world knew that nothing he was saying was true, could he have been so dumb and so misinformed and I knew it just from reading the papers? Come on.
Yeah, but what paper? The New York Times?
No, actually, the New York Times was one of the papers that was fielding all these BS stories written by this woman, Judith Miller, who is now actually cooling her heels in jail because she refuses to testify about who was her source for outing a CIA agent. And what's wrong with the New York Times?
They're left wing. They're no good. They don't tell the truth.
How do you know? How often do you read the New York Times?
I never read it.
All right. Thanks a lot, pal. Oh, I got to love it. Here's Rick in Detroit. Rick, sorry, I must have cut you off. Go ahead. You're on the air.
How you doing, Peter?
Doing great.
I got to play devil's advocate with you, too, though. I do agree with you about the gas. So let's park there just for a second. I'll try to be quick.
Sure.
You're right about the gas. It's such a joke in this country. And if money is going over there, if there's any truth to what you said, people in this country should be up in arms about that big time.
I mean, well, I'm just reading. I read from the New York Times. I mean, of course, this guy that just wrote says that he knows it's terrible and he never reads it. I mean, the New York Times is filled with lies as well. I mean, it's often got much, much more accurate information than a lot of the television and a lot of other papers. But you have to be skeptical, as I was saying, about all sources. But here's the guy who said, the New York Times, that's lies. How often do you read it? I never read it. How does he know? All right, go ahead. Sorry, Rick.
No, it's okay. You're fine. I'm just playing devil's advocate with you on the other end. But you're right about the thing about I liked what you had to say about the gas, the 350. You know, 275 is going to look like a deal when they jack it up to 350. And you know, something needs to be done. They're killing the poor people in this country. Things are bad enough. It's a regressive tax against the poor.
Sure.
I will agree with Clyde on one thing. The young man, and I feel bad for him, he's in a better place now, but he joined the military. When you join the military, you can have the expectation to go to war. That might sound cold, but he was right. When you join the military, the expectation is when your country calls you up, you go to war.
Well, except that here is the difference here. The country should be calling you up to defend its interests, not to have plans to dominate a region because it possesses a resource that the far right wing and the corporate interests in this country, the oil interests, think is important for us to control directly. And, you know, if there's a security concern, well, sure, that's what the armed forces are for. There was nothing like that here. So she feels that his life was wasted.
Sure, have three children too, and I probably feel the same way. I can sympathize with her. I can't empathize with her, but I can sympathize with her. I couldn't imagine losing one of my children. So if she felt that strongly, it's understandable. The right or the wrong of it is, I think the people on the left will be bashing Bush either way if he went to Iraq or didn't go to Iraq. Everyone's kind of forgotten what happened with 9-1-1.
Wait. What's 9-1-1? Wait, Rick. What does 9-1-1 have to do with this?
I think 9-1-1 had to do with the fact that what happened to this country. It was the first time we were ever invaded. It's the first time we were ever. It was the first time that deaths happened on our soil. You know, left the Civil War, Revolutionary War,
Pearl Harbor,
in the last 100 years, where we were somewhat invaded.
Right.
In a sense.
Right. Well, it made sense to try to capture and destroy the operational base of the people that were responsible for it in Afghanistan. But it's been shown over and over again that the resources that could have been used to capture Osama bin Laden were diverted to Iraq, because what happened, this set in motion this long-standing agenda that the neocons, the neoconservatives, had to control oil resources in the Middle East. So, and what they've done, of course, is to create more and more terrorists, more and more hatred for the United States and the West around the world, in Muslim countries, and among some, hopefully, very, very few young Muslim men. But enough. Remember, if you got 99, you know, if you said 99% of people which they are, good and decent and what have you, you got 1% of Muslim young men that are willing to do something awful of the type that we've seen over the last few years, we're in a world of trouble. And what has happened is Bush, because of his actions, has exacerbated that, made this more dangerous, has created the loss of more American lives. All right, I got to move on some. So thank you, Rick. Appreciate it. We'll be right back.
This is WRIM.com. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this. Muskie fishermen, get ready to compete for big money. The OSI Pro Series WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Championship Series is underway. There's still time to enter to win cash and prizes if you can boat the biggest fish on September 17th. Sign up now for the Muskie Championship. Slots will fill up fast, so get your entry in today. Compete for thousands of dollars in cash and prizes, including the DMF Bait Award for the kid under 16 landing the largest fish on live bait. It's all going to be given away to the best fishing team in town, so sign up now by calling 248-591-6841 or go to WRIF.com for an entry form. There will be fun for everyone at the post-event party at Hooters, so call 248-591-6841 to become the OSI Pro Series WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series champion. Call 248-591-6841 today. Brought to you by OSI Pro Series, professional grade caulk, sealants, and adhesives. Complete battery source, every battery for every need, and 101 WRIF. The movie Deuce Bigelow, European Gigolo, and five other first-run movies are now showing at the drive-ins at the Pontiac Silverdome and CompuWare Sports Arena in Plymouth. See Double Features Nightly, where you'll get two first-run movies for the price of one. For more info at the Dome, log on to silverdome.com or call 248-456-1613. For CompuWare movies, log on to CompuWareHockey.com or call 734-927-3284 for movies at the drive-in, with two movies for the price of one, 7 days a week.
Detroit's Rock Station 101 WRIF and WRIF.com bring you the hottest deals in the Motor City. At WRIF.com, you are only one click away from dining at some of your favorite restaurants for only half price. Dine online and eat for less. Save a ton of money with some of Metro Detroit's best restaurants, like Bellasino's Pizza and Grinders with 17 locations. Go to www.bellasinos.com to find a Bellasino's near you. Log on to www.wrif.com. You can purchase full-price gift certificates to area restaurants for only half price. But quantities are limited, so you better act fast. For more details, log on to WRIF.com and be sure to check out even more special offers and savings. Like Buddy's Pizza, come into any of Buddy's 9 locations today. Enjoy one of the nation's best pizza places as recognized by the Food Network. Buddy's, Detroit's number one pizza since 1946. Log on today and save at WRIF.com.
Here's the most radical statement ever made by a college. Do not waste your money going to college. Who's making such a bold statement? The only one who can, Henry Ford Community College. HFCC wants you to get what you deserve for your money, an education that will help you in your effort to get ahead in life. Your best choice for that effort is Henry Ford Community College. we're so confident we are, we guarantee it in three ways. Your courses are guaranteed to help you in your future job. They're guaranteed to transfer to a four-year college or university. And your tuition is guaranteed to remain the same while you get your degree. The economy's just too tough today to take chances, so don't waste your money or your time. Choose Henry Ford Community College, your best choice guaranteed. Make the smart choice. Call 1-800-585-HFCC or go to hfcc.edu for details about our guarantees. Hit it!
Ford, sick of the jolly good gas station, sick of the jolly good gas station, sick of the jolly good gas station, which nobody can deny.
Yep, Citgo has been getting people where they need to go for 40 years now. Because if you're driving somewhere, you pretty much have to buy gas. And if you have to buy something, you may as well buy it from nice people who treat you like a neighbor, not just a customer. Stop into any one of Citgo's 13,000 locally owned and operated locations from Sioux City to Miami, and you'll find quality fuel, a well-stocked convenience store, and the same friendly service as always. And to all the people who have helped make our first 40 years great, we'd just like to say thanks, and we look forward to many more.
With gas and snacks and drinks, with gas and snacks and drinks.
Citgo, helping people get where they need to go for 40 years and counting.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
All right, thank you very much, and welcome back. We're talking about gas prices. What are they at now? Like $2.59, I saw it. $34 to fill up my car, and it's not really a big one. Iraqis are getting subsidized gasoline, so they're getting it 6 cents a gallon. 6 cents a gallon. Who's doing the subsidizing? Ah, you and me. You know, so we're not subsidizing our schools. We're not subsidizing our infrastructure. We're not subsidizing a national health program or anything like that. Give the people that don't have health insurance something that they, you know, they're not going to be bankrupt by illness. No, it's all going over there. We're also talking about Cindy Sheehan. She's the mom who lost her son, Casey, and she set up Camp Casey outside of Bush's ranch where he's spending 5 weeks. This man has taken more vacations than any president in the history of the United States. Jamcan says, all power to Cindy Sheehan. Get the moron off the air who defends the bushwhacker. Well, anybody can get on the air. 313-298-WRIF. And let's see, there was one other one. Oh, yeah. Joe from Canton writes, plan on gasoline getting to about $3 to $3.50 or better by the end of the year. A friend of mine was told that her friend works at a gas station, and they were told by the company to keep raising the price of gas high and keep raising it until it gets to $3.50 or $4 a gallon. Well, when you start getting a friend of a friend, that's sort of the basis of urban legend. But, two things. It looks like it's going that way. And the other thing is, even if it doesn't, it really shows our mood. It really shows that we are ready. We're sheep to be fleeced. We are the sheeple. We are the sheeple. Unless we do something, unless we get up on our hind legs and act like human beings. Where did I see this? I have one more thing here. Jay Hudson is our producer and phone screener, and Jay, you can call our guest in Crawford, Texas. We're going to be talking with Barry Crimmins, who's down there on assignment for the Air America Network, so I hope we can get him. By the way, when I worked on the IE America Radio Network, that's the IE America Radio Network, was owned by the United Auto Workers, and I did that from 2000 to 2003, and it was nationally syndicated around the country. Two of my favorite spots were Santa Fe and Santa Cruz, Santa Fe, New Mexico, and Santa Cruz, California, and it looks like I'm going to be broadcasting back into both of them. I've been invited once again to be on Camp Love Wave. I love that. Only in Santa Fe, Camp Love Wave. And so they've invited me back on their program, which is going to be Saturday, August 20th. This is coming up at 11 a.m. Eastern Time. 11 a.m. Eastern Time on KSFR. KSFR 90.7 FM. It streams. So if you want to hear a little bit more of me, you can hear me on KSFR in Santa Fe. Hell yeah, I get it. Santa Fe Radio. And it'll be on my website, peterwerby.com. Also, and this will be sweet revenge if this happens, and I think it will, somewhere along the line, this owner of the station in Santa Cruz, K-O-M-Y. So when I actually went out there twice and broadcast live on it, and I was always calling it Commie Radio, which he didn't like. But finally, he fired me. His mother made him fire me. And in fact, a year after they didn't get fired. It wasn't like he was paying me. They just kicked the affiliate, our affiliate, off their airwaves. And so he was doing all right-wing stuff. And so, but his mom really controls everything. And his mom, a year after I was booted off, and there was this international campaign. He got about 4,000 emails denouncing him. And he would call me and whine, why'd you do that? Why'd you give him my personal email? And never felt very good about this guy. So it seems like, and I'll give you more information as the weeks go on, that I will be hosting or substitute hosting for Peter B. Collins, a great broadcaster out at KRXA 540 AM in Monterey and Santa Cruz. I'll be back in Santa Cruz. And I know there's people still listening from Santa Fe and Santa Cruz. So more on that as we continue. All right, let's see. All right, we have our guest. That's good. Let's go to our phones right now. It is, in fact, our guest that is in Crawford, Texas right now. It's Barry Crimmins, and Barry Crimmins is a political satirist. He's a writer for Air America's Randy Rhodes Show, and he's the author of Never Shake Hands with a War Criminal. Good idea. And his website is Barry Crimmins, C-R-I-M-M-I-N-S, BarryCrimmins.com. And he's there at Camp Casey with Cindy Sheehan. Barry, welcome to the show.
Full disclosure, I'm actually down in my hotel in Waco because I'm writing something for the Boston Phoenix tonight. But I've been up there since Thursday a lot of the time.
What's the scene there? It sounds...
Great. It's a great feeling. It's really, you know, one of the best... It's amazing. Who'd have thought you'd go to Crawford, Texas... You'd have to go to Crawford, Texas to finally feel among your own element in the United States. What were the odds? But that's what's happened. It's a really great feeling. It's growing, and, you know, and clearly they don't know what to do. They just don't know what to do about this problem. Bush has had his chance. I mean, you know, Bush, Mr. Doctrine of Preemption, could have come out here a week ago and done something about this. He could have courageously done something. Instead, what does he do? He uses his, you know, Mr. Neighbor, Mr. Friendliness, Mr. Good to Your Neighbors, Good Folks guy, uses all of his neighbors in Crawford, Texas as a human shield. Well, in some cases, you know, I may be stretching the term. But, you know, it's just dragged on and on. And, you know, Bush had his chance to make his preemptive strike and go out and face the music, and he didn't. And so now he just sort of, you know, looks like this coward. And the Republican Party, the pro-family party, has now come out against motherhood.
Well, there's been incredible attacks on Cindy Sheehan, her motives, what she had said previously about Bush. I'm surprised they haven't started delving into her sex life. Oh, Karl Rove probably has got some people on the case.
Well, if he has them on the case, they're fiction writers, of course. But, yeah, I mean, no, it's a choice America is going to have to make. You want to take Cindy's word or Condi's word? And, I'm with Cindy. And, I'm in the media, and, I'm tired of being part of, a greater group that, under the false guise of objectivity, gives equal weight, to lies and truth. And instead of getting to the bottom of various issues, I mean, this woman is a grieving mother. How she first reacted and the circumstances she was first in with Bush, you know, was one thing. But in the time, I mean, how much more have we learned about the lies that led us to that war in the time that has elapsed since she lost her son on April 4th, 2004. A lot of things. I mean, a lot of us knew this was a lie from the start, but this woman in her process of grieving has taken her grief and done something remarkable with it and has started, it's a spark that now the prairie fire is now sweeping Crawford, Texas.
Barry Crimmins is my guest here on Night Call, and he's in Waco, Texas right now, but he's been out to Crawford. And what's the scene out there? What's it like?
Oh, it's amazing. I mean, I've been doing reports, hourly reports. I've been putting guests on with Randy Rhoads' show Monday through Fridays, 3 to 7 on the east, in the east. And it's just been amazing to put these people on the air and let them tell their stories and realize that for once you can hear this stuff unfettered. We've been able to put Gold Star family members on the air who have told these remarkable stories. We put Iraq veterans against the war on the air, and we put just many citizens who have just shown up in support of Cindy from every corner of the country, and everyone's pulling together. It's it's a difficult physical circumstance, but it's not hard for, but no one is complaining about it because we understand that Crawford, Texas is a hell of a lot more pleasant than
Iraq.
Baghdad.
What's the physical scene there? I mean, is it like 100 degrees and...
Well, you know why so many Texans chew tobacco?
Why?
You can't tell when you're smoking. Did I inhale? I don't know. The air is very heavy. It's very humid, but there is a merciful breeze that blows most of the time. That's most of the mercy that was in that town until these people have shown up. But there are people in the town who have been supportive of the protesters. And there's some people that aren't. It was very funny. Friday night, there was some right-wing talk show host got supposedly sponsored several buses to come up. Well, it turned out it was only one bus load. In Texas, this is how strong their cause is. When they got an air-conditioned, they're going to send as many air-conditioned buses as they can get out of Dallas full of Republicans. They could muster one bus full of people, and they were all mostly senior citizens, so I have to think they were being told they were being taken to Canada to pick up, prescription medicine or something. But it was funny. It was called the Cowtown Bus, and off of this Cowtown Bus came these sheep, and they got off, and then they lasted about 15 minutes and left. These people aren't even good sunshine patriots.
There is, as the right wing machine is beginning to work on Cindy, and they say that she has hidden agendas, that she's a tool of the left. That you're hearing a lot of that.
This is the biggest bunch of hooey I've ever heard. A war is a political situation, and people have stands on political situations, and alliances are developed in political situations. And if someone, and people who happen to have a record or a background of being politically active show up and assist and say, yes, I agree with you, I agree with your message, and I stand in solidarity with you, and if you're going to screen them, well, you've taken other political stands in the past, and then we wouldn't want to be tied to you. But on the other hand, you can get these crackpots who are up there waving American flags, walking around with Camp Gitmo T-shirts on, and nobody's wondering who's provoking them, what side that's on, and if there's anything right or wrong about their angle or their approach or who's supporting or paying for them. You want to talk about people getting controlled by people? Why don't we look into people like Scaife? It's just silly. It just proves you can say anything in a row that you want to say, and if it has a period on it and you stand there and look like you mean what you said, it makes sense. But it makes about a lot of what I've heard, it makes about as much sense as some of the bumper stickers I see. Like I saw one today that said Jesus is alive and and fish don't walk.
Well, then
it had a picture of a fish upside down with legs on it and Darwin written on the fish.
Wow, hey.
I always believed in evolution, but now that I meet some of the people that are around here, you know, it has shaken my I just wonder.
That reminds me. Ted Nugent has moved down there. Has he appeared?
I haven't seen Ted, but... maybe he was with the guy who was shooting his gun off today. There was some guy shot his gun off a few times, and it was picked up in the news. And,
right. Well, I got to go, but how long is this going to last? Until Bush's vacation is over?
It's not a vacation. It's a hiatus, isn't it, when it's that long? But, she says she's going to be there till August 31st, and I think I'll be around for a lot of that time. So we'll be keeping you posted, and I hope people come down, help out. If they can't help out that way, they may come. There's plenty of ways to give financial support. And just talk it up in your community or go to demonstrations in your community.
Yeah, actually, there's one in Detroit tomorrow, Monday, at the U.S. Federal Building, downtown Detroit, Michigan Avenue at Cass Avenue, 4 to 5:30 p.m. So 4 to 5:30 p.m., you go to my website, all the details. Barry Crimmins, thanks a lot. I really appreciate it. Thanks for the report.
My pleasure.
All right.
Talk to you soon.
Bye-bye now. Barry Crimmins, who's been in Crawford, Texas, covering the Cindy Sheehan situation. And I did that from memory. I was trying to I had some sheet here about the demonstration tomorrow. Anyways, if you support Cindy Sheehan, which essentially is supporting an end to this war. Frank Rich, writing in the New York Times, that our first caller said he never reads because it's filled with lies, this is an opinion, and there's a column he has today that says, someone tell the president the war is over. And it says, like the Japanese soldier marooned on an island for years after VJ Day, Bush may be the last person in the country to learn that for Americans, if not Iraqis, the war is over. We will stay the course, he insistently tells us from the ranch. But he can't stay the course when his own citizens won't stay with him. His approval rate for handling of Iraq has plunged to 66% of the people oppose what he's doing. If you think about it, I mean, what a fool's mission this was from the beginning. And the kind of arrogance, what they call hubris, H-U-B-R-I-S, the hubris, this monumental arrogance, this assault on Iraq was. I mean, have these men learned nothing? See, they weren't in the Vietnam War. They all scammed out of it, all the Republican chicken hawks. They supported the war politically, but they made sure that they didn't fight in it by any number of scams and what have you. And if you think about it, the United States hasn't won a war in 60 years. And Korea was a stalemate in which we lost, I forgot what the figure was, 35 or 40,000 Americans. We killed 1 million Korean citizens. We lost the war in Vietnam, and the Vietnamese, the Indochinese paid with 3 million civilian deaths, us with around 60,000. And then there were these little fake wars that Bush and Reagan and then Bush Papa put together, Grenada and then Panama. Both of them just it was an exercise in order to fly the flag and give this military bearing to these Republicans. And then this. Oh, so, wait, I'm sorry, the Gulf War. Yeah, we forgot about the Gulf War. We beat Iraq handily, but not enough to stop this repeat performance from occurring. When will we learn? When will we learn to take care of ourselves first? It's because the people in charge don't care about us. They talk these sweet, sappy little platitudes about family values and our country, and that not one of them means it. They're loyal to their own class, this small class of rulers, this 1% that controls almost all the wealth and all the political power. They've got these grand schemes. Most of them always fail. Most of them fail. But it doesn't matter when you're that rich. It's like some of the guys I went to college with, that these rich kids that, if you're just an ordinary middle-class kid or working-class kid and you did something wrong, you're out of school. These guys, because their fathers, did endowments and what have you, they get drunk, smash up cars, get in big fights, knock up their girlfriends, get mostly, failing grades, and there they'd be in class on Monday. Wow, just like nothing happened. That's Bush. That's Bush's financial life, and that's every error that these right-wingers have made all the way for the last 50 years. I mean, the reason that Iran is what it is today is because of what the United States carried out in 1954 and overthrew a democratic elected government. And I don't want to go through the whole history of it again. Go look it up. Go just put in 1954 Iran. See what comes up on Google for you. The war against the people of Central America in the 80s, which led to this incredible violation of the Constitution, and actually with Reagan funding Iran and our people smuggling cocaine back into the United States. One mistake after the next, but it doesn't matter. All the people that committed these criminal acts, not only were they pardoned, but many of them brought back into Bush 2 government. So crime does pay if you're rich, and that's who Bush represents, period. Period. Absolutely period. He'll throw a few crumbs, religious crapperoo to, these people that care deeply about things, but he didn't care either. They're about one thing. Well, two. Let's give them two. Money and power. But they got to have the power to have the money. All right, 313-298-WRIF. The person making all these statements is just me, Peter Werby. Let's go to Randy in Westland. Hey, Randy, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for waiting.
Hi.
Hi.
I just wanted to talk about the gas prices and what a scam it is. The oil has had a monopoly for like over 50 years, and there are many alternate fuels right now, but the car companies are just worried about getting this hydrogen deal going. But they can make cars run right now on compressed natural gas, the same gas you use in your hot water heater or your stove. They can make cars run on propane. They can even make cars run on methane gas. I know you've probably heard of Waste Management, the garbage company.
Sure, sure.
They're the single largest operator of landfills in the country, and they're the single largest operator or owner of a fleet of trucks. All trucks are built by Mack Truck. They made a deal with Mack Truck. We'll buy our trucks exclusively from you, provided you can make them run on methane. So they get fuel from their landfills, which is good. But they're still wasting a ton of methane. They could make cars run on methane right now. And if there's one thing we've got, it's plenty of garbage and plenty of landfills.
Wait. You mean the waste management truck that's picking up my garbage is running on methane?
Methane gas. That's why you'll never see one filling up at a gas station with either diesel or gasoline fuel.
Wow. And what I've said, people say, oh, all you do is criticize Bush and all that. I say we've got to have a crash program to get off of fossil fuels, period.
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, they can also make cars run on ethanol and methanol. You ever seen Top Fuel dragsters and funny cars?
Sure.
They run on 100% alcohol.
They do.
What do they make alcohol out of?
Corn.
Vegetables, corn.
Yeah.
Exactly. So, I mean, what have we got plenty of? Land. What are the farmers doing? Starving. They could be growing corn. I mean, I know they talk about that generically altered corn and vegetables, but no one wants to eat them.
Uh-huh.
But it's supposed to be better, bigger. But they could say, okay, well, we'll let you do that with this kind of corn, provided it doesn't be made for human consumption. It's for fuel.
Sure. Well, Randy, let's just be completely precise, though. Farmers aren't starving. The family farmer, the ordinary farmer,
correct,
which is an endangered species, is
correct,
the one that's doing it. The agribusiness that's driven them out of this occupation that goes back to the dawn of time, they're the ones that are doing fine. Well, right you are. I mean, when people say, what's your solution? I say, disengage 100% from the Middle East, which means we'd have to get off of oil.
Well, we've been, especially since World War II, the infrastructure is set up for oil. I mean, they ship oil and gasoline and underground pipes from Texas to Chicago to New York. So they kind of got the world, in their hands, because they've been the dominant thing for years. And the thing would be, how do you set up the infrastructure? First, you've got to have the car manufacturers make these vehicles that will run on this stuff. It's a fact that they can run on the stuff, but there's no infrastructure in place. And so that's what they need. You need to be able to pull into a gas station and have your choice between the three regular gases we have now, propane, vegetable oil. I mean, that's another thing. Have you heard about the cars?
Sure.
That make Diesels run on vegetable oil.
Absolutely. I was mentioning Santa Fe earlier. There was someone who drove me around in a Mercedes that had been converted to run on vegetable oil. Yeah, what the waste that comes from the back of McDonald's. All that grease that comes out of it.
And going back to the methane, if you go by, like, there's a landfill at 275 and Michigan Avenue in Canton. I work at the truck plant right there in Wayne, the Michigan truck plant, and next door is where they build the Focus. And they also use some of that methane fuel to make electricity and also to heat the plant and cool, whatever, you know, they use it for energy.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's great. There's alternatives, but what happens is when there's what, you know, what they call, you know, this word, a paradigm of how something operates, the impetus to do nothing, the inertia is right there. Well, what does it take to get us off the dime to realize that we can't keep doing this, that it's deadly, that oil is and the other fossil fuels are deadly to the planet, and they engender wars? It's not the way to go. Randy, I got to go. So thank you very much. I appreciate your call very much. We'll be right back.
WRIF.com. WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
So you're a slot machine.
Oh, I prefer arbitrary investment return specialist.
Uh-huh. It probably surprises people to know that you talk.
And people listen.
Really?
Oh, yeah. I can be very persuasive. It's in my nature. By the way, do you think you could find it in your heart to spare a dollar?
Yeah, sure. I think I've got one.
See? Huh? Gotcha.
Boy, you were good.
It's a gift. But look, bottom line, gambling should be fun. People need to remember to...
gamble responsibly?
Exactly. As my Uncle Edgar used to say, put some balance in your life.
That's thoughtful advice.
That'll be $5.
Here you go.
Ah, got you again.
A reminder that if you gamble, please gamble responsibly.
Pardon me.
To learn about the warning signs of problem gambling, you can call 1-800-270-7117. A reminder from the Michigan Department of Community Health and the Michigan Association of Broadcasters. Say, you still need that dollar?
Oh, it's just too easy.
That's 1-800-270-7117.
The party just doesn't stop. Tuesday nights with The Riff at Leopard's Lounge and Royal, Windsor's number one gentleman's club. Join 101 WRIF this and every Tuesday night for Riff Night at Leopard's Lounge and Broil. The Riff, Susie Cole, will be there to party hard, and she'll have a ton of free Riff gear to give away, plus lots of other surprises. But you can't get them if you don't come out. Remember, guys, every week at Leopard's Lounge, they bring you new girls from all over the world, so it never gets boring. Plus, unlike other gentlemen's clubs, at Leopard's Lounge, you never pay a cover charge, ever. It's the best entertainment value around. Guys, you work hard. You deserve a night out, so make sure it's Riff Night with Susie Cole this Tuesday night at Leopard's Lounge, and get ready to enjoy the finer things in life. Beer, free Riff stuff, and sexy, beautiful women. We'll see you at Leopard's Lounge in Windsor, just 5 minutes from the bridge or tunnel at 1190 Wyandotte West. Call 1-888-653-8881 for Leopard's Lounge in Broil. Transportation provided by Royal Limousine in Plymouth. Call 866-MY-ROYAL.
Are you looking for a unique tattoo to set you apart from the crowd? Well, Inkslingers offers one-of-a-kind artistic designs you won't find anywhere else. There has never been a more perfect time to have that tattoo you always wanted. Inkslingers offers same-day service and walk-ins are always welcome. Inkslingers has tattooed nearly 500,000 Metro Detroiters and continues to lead the market with their exclusive designs. Their proven safety system is second to none. Call 1-888-TATTOOS and get that tattoo you've been dreaming of. Inkslingers offers a professional, clean environment with several studios to serve you. Inkslingers headquarters has moved from 12 in Gratiot to south of 9 on Gratiot. Visit Inkslingers in Dearborn Heights, Sterling Heights, Centerline, or East Point. What are you waiting for? Come in and get that tattoo you've been dreaming of and learn how you can get your next tattoo free. This offer is good for a limited time only. Call 1-888-TATTOOS for more information. That's 1-888-TATTOOS. Inkslingers, offering professional, friendly service for more than 15 years.
So what's going on in the house that Rock built, David?
Whoa, excuse me?
What's happening at Rock Financial?
Oh, the newest, the latest and greatest. I got a doozy for you.
Real? A doozy?
I love the word doozy.
Okay, Beaver Cleaver.
Quick and easy. No pay stubs, no W-2s, no tax returns. A lot of folks have asked me about this. It's not a new one. It's an oldie but a goodie. Here's the deal. If you maybe are paid on commission, you're self-employed, you're in between jobs, there are so many factors of why you would want to use the Quick and Easy loan. And the interest rate on our Quick and Easy loan is extremely close to market rates. It's not 2 or 3% higher. We're talking right there.
So you don't slam the door on people just because they aren't conventional.
Thank you. That's exactly what I was trying to say.
Help everybody?
She could have done it in 5 seconds. It took me 60.
Well, you can call the Rock Financial Experts, and they'll fill in the rest.
Right.
800-333-ROCK. They're home of the mortgage experts, and you can visit them online at rockfinancial.com. Rock Financial, a Quicken Loans Company, equal housing lender. Call today, 800-333-ROCK.
It's a doozy. They're quick and easy. It's a doozy.
You doozy.
Doozy.
Get
Oh, hello to you. It is Woody. Every year, we have the running of the bears. We set the bears loose, and the mass have to run to the bar at the far end of the village for a refreshing smear of ice. It's perfectly safe. There are plenty of slower runners than me.
Smear of ice. Brrr. Please drink responsibly. Copyright 2005, the Smirnoff Company, Norwalk, Connecticut. Smirnoff Ice, premium malt beverage made in the USA.
Get.
Hello, guys. It is Uri. Whenever I go to a party, I always invite at least one person who isn't drinking. They may not join in with the singing, dancing, and playing Pass the Weasel, but they make excellent designated drivers. Another glass of yak's milk, Grandmother? Smirnoff Ice. Please drink responsibly.
Copyright 2005, the Smirnoff Company, Norwalk, Connecticut. Smirnoff Ice, premium malt beverage made in the USA.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome back. This is our second hour. Then at 1 a.m. Eastern Time, we'll have a couple of interviews, including an incredibly interesting one about Thomas Paine. You know, these right-wingers are always talking about the founding fathers. Thomas Paine, I think, the most interesting and perhaps the one with the most lasting influence. But that'll be at 1 a.m. Let's see. Here is some email to calltalkyes@yahoo.com. Calltalkyes@yahoo.com. This is Robert from Port Huron. He says, I'm sending this email to you to tell you that there is no question that the oil companies are ripping us off. That's one of the things we're talking about. So if you want to call us, 313-298-WRIF. And also we're talking about Cindy Sheehan, the mom who is asking... probably, say, demanding an interview, an audience with George Bush about the death of her son, Casey. She's down in Crawford, Texas, and isn't leaving until he leaves after another one of his extended vacations. Anyways, Robert says, I know they are using high crude oil prices as a crutch, as an excuse to charge exorbitantly high gasoline prices, but by the same token, they are reaping in record profits. I'd like to ask the CEOs of these oil companies, how much money is enough? Now, there is a during the 1890s, there were these writers called the muckrakers, and they got all the goods on the corporate robber barons, same type that are ruling us today, although people then really were resisting. They had mass movements of resistance against being ripped off. The populists, the union movements of that time, and a lot of just other popular-based resistance. Anyways, in Frank Norris's book, The Octopus, at one point, this man who has been ruined by the railroads and the exorbitant rates that they've charged the farmers, they said, how much will you charge us? And this agent of the railway says, all the traffic will bear. I just always remember that. That's what he said coldly. In other words, I'm going to charge you as absolute much as I can. Until there's like a countervailing competitor, which doesn't look like it's happening. There's not going to be another oil company. So, we're going to give it to you for $1.75. And so then it's just back to popular resistance. By the way, if you're ringing now, please hold on. Our producer and phone screener, Jay Hudson, will be with you in 1 minute. So just keep ringing. And interestingly, though, Robert says, yet pieces of garbage like Rush Limbaugh say, quote, Americans should stop complaining about high fuel prices and earn more money. So you get these neocons, these millionaire neocons, these multimillionaire neoconservatives, heartless, absolutely heartless. By the way, those of us who are concerned that WhiteRoseSociety.org, that archives has showed that they've been having technical problems, but now all of their files are back up, and so you can get the last couple of weeks of this show and this week as well, beginning probably just later this morning. Also, we will be podcasting this program soon. I think beginning tonight that we will have just the interviews, and next week we'll get to the whole show on there. All right, let's get back to our phones, because I know that Bill has been waiting an extraordinary amount of time in Windsor, so this is an international call. Bill, thanks for your patience, and my apologies.
Hi, how are you?
Good, what's up?
Good. I just wanted to know, don't you think that we're a nation as a whole? Well, I'm calling from Canada. But don't you think we're too complacent? I mean, don't you think something should happen? I caught the tail end of your last conversation where you said, you know, it's going to go up to 3 and we'll complain then. But don't you think the middle class as a whole is just content with everything to be normal? As long as we get by, everything's okay.
And well, how about you? I mean, you must, I suspect, since 90% of us are working class or middle class,
yes.
That are you...
Yeah, I mean, I try and do everything I can to save as much gas as I can. I mean, I got to cross the border every day to go to work, and it's actually cheaper at the border to buy gas by a good 15 cents. I don't understand the reason, but if you're going back to Canada, right now I think gas there is maybe $2.33, where everyone else is $2.45. But I just think the middle class is just too content with what they got, and I just think it takes a lot for them to get excited. I don't think they get excited until it really hits them. It reminds me of, I don't remember if you remember the movie Hoosiers, the one character, the former coach, tells Gene Hackman's character that he doesn't mind, that, you know, he doesn't really worry about problems, about a dog coming and pooping on his in the middle of the road until it does it in its front lawn. And I think that's what's happening right now.
Well, it's hard to say, because for one thing, there isn't a great there's not a lot of great avenues for people to express themselves. And so, for instance, if there was some huge mass movement, or people would be doing something. But right now, if someone said, you know, I'm tired of these prices. I know I'm getting gouged. I know I'm getting screwed at about 100 different levels by the elites of this society. I'm going to go out tomorrow and but then all of a sudden, you know, there's nowhere to go. So I think what happens, two things. One thing, people are frustrated and don't have any way to express it. And then there are a whole bunch of other people who just think, man, there's nothing I can do because, the big shots have this all sewed up.
Well, yeah, that's true. But I think what happens is, I think from a young age, we're taught that, everything is okay and this is the way society is.
Sure.
This is just natural. I just think actually the youth of this country are just programmed to, you know, just pay, and that they should accept these rising prices of inflation. I think
that's the role of these right wing commentators. Keep telling you everything's all right. You've got it the best that there can be, and you can say, well, no, look at other places. And they go. Yeah, go ahead.
The late 70s, I think prices for consumer goods have almost, I don't know. I mean, they've got to. Not more, just more than quadruple. They've gone up maybe 300-400%. But
yeah, they've gone up. Actually, all of us are in today's dollars or in 1975 dollars, making less. There's less net worth. All this stuff like that. And mm-hmm. and but there hasn't been a manner in which people could confront this, and that's what's got to happen. And what these guys are all overplaying their hand. I mean, like I said, they have such arrogance, and it's this arrogance. Doesn't matter how stupid they are, doesn't matter. They're rich, so they have this incredible arrogance that's based in the power that they wield, and so they think they can essentially do anything because there's no consequences.
Exactly,
you can break all the laws, you can screw people, you can create wars in which tens of thousands, in some cases, millions of people get killed, and what happens to you? Even when people are sorry, somebody like the Secretary of Defense during the Johnson years, 40 years ago, McNamara, he's going around saying, "Well, I guess I knew the war was wrong." Well, tell that to the 60,000 Americans that got killed and the 3 million Vietnamese that got killed.
You know, we went through this in Canada when the GST came on. I don't know if you know about the GST, the Goods and Services Tax, but
right.
The flat 7%, you know, and that caused some places like Newfoundland where their sales tax was already 12 or 11%. I mean, they're paying 18% on everything.
Wow.
You know, the cry went out for a couple of years, and then after a while, people just stuck with it. I just think people with, you know, society today with our short attention spans, they're just only going to put up with it so much, and as soon as they get a little bit of relief, they're just going to live with it.
It could be.
And the other.
Yeah. Well, you know what, Bill? Actually, I know you waited a long time, but I do have to move on. So thank you for making our program international. I certainly appreciate it. Let's see here. Hi, you're on the air. Who's this?
Adam Way Casey from Belleville, Michigan.
Go ahead, Adam. You're on the air.
Hi, I'd like to just say a few points. First off, you know, I'm not right wing or left wing. I don't consider myself either. I consider myself a moderate.
Okay.
So I ain't going to go in the argument.
All right, go ahead. What's on your mind?
On my mind right now is if we were going to go to war in Iraq, if that was no question about it, what was with all the posturing and all the showboating, pretty much we did, saying, you know what, forget the UN, doing all, we pretty much laughed in their face. And my view or point is, if we were going to do that, if we were going to go into war, why did we take so much time to do it? Because back in the Gulf War, 91, what did Saddam do with his fighter aircraft to run away from Mars? He flew them into Iran. He never got them back, but he did fly them there. He got rid of them. My viewpoint is, Saddam, he probably did have some weapons of mass destruction somewhere in Iraq at the time, before we ran in. But you know what? He probably, most likely, pulled the exact same thing he did in 91 and got rid of them.
Now, there's no real reason to think that, to tell you the truth, and it's something we've been going over a million times. I mean, Bush and his investigated that, and where are they? There's nowhere. There were never any weapons of mass destruction. All right, thank you so much. Here's, I actually can't make out the name, but calling from Waterford, is it Foe?
No, it's Theo.
Theo, okay.
Theo.
There are a few syllables missing here. Theo.
Yeah, hey, how you doing?
Good, what's up?
You know what, aside of the oil and the money issues, you know, I'm just more concerned about the crimes against humanity issues. I mean, women over there for infidelity get murdered. I mean, here, you know, they get divorced. And I've seen on video, you know, maybe I'm not educated enough, maybe it wasn't in Iraq, but I've seen where the crowds stand around why women that are still wearing shrouds get shot in the back of the head. And
well, actually, I think you're probably talking about Afghanistan, but you're on to something important, that since Iraq under Saddam Hussein was a secular nation, it was not a Muslim nation, that
right.
Women were granted equal status, and under this new constitution that Bush is trying to force them to put together by 12 o'clock, it would grant religious courts power over women, and women are beginning to be forced out of the public sphere. So women stand a chance to have their position eroded severely under this new free government.
Oh, is that right? Really?
Yeah.
Like it'd get worse than better, huh? I mean, because that was my only thing that would actually make me even think about strapping boots on and going over there is, you know, I've seen on TV girls just wearing shrouds and getting shot in public, and the woman who's getting shot in public's definitely probably got some kids out there, and just it just flabbergasts me, you know, that that wouldn't happen here. Our government wouldn't stand for that, you know. And maybe that wasn't Iraq, maybe it was just Afghanistan, but my thing was crimes against humanity. They talk about a lot of bad things that happened in the prisons that Saddam's sons ran, and
oh, I thought you were going to be talking about Abu Ghraib and what we've done since we've been there. But no, I mean, I don't think it holds a candle to the kind of terrible things that went on in Iraq under Saddam Hussein. You got to remember, though, too, is that all this was going on during the 1980s when Reagan and Papa Bush was sending all sorts of aid to Saddam. All right, thank you very much, Theo. Appreciate it. That reminded me of this, though. This is going to surprise you. In fact, maybe get your opinion on this one as well, 313-298-WRIF. And, you know, there's all these photographs and these videos of what American troops did to Iraqi prisoners. And these weren't, if you remember, these were not insurgents. These were not people that had shot or killed or, you know, Americans had done anything like that. Turned out that most of them, the overwhelming number of them, had done nothing. and but they just became the objects of torture for these twisted folks. And a lot of them were, of course, interrogated by methods that had been approved up as high as Rumsfeld, the Secretary of War. And what was his position then? Gonzalez, was he just the advisor to the president? Said all things like the Geneva Convention. We don't have to pay attention to that. Anyway, so there's still all these photographs of these humiliations and tortures and that have been done to Iraqi prisoners by our soldiers. And the American Civil Liberties Union has brought a suit under the Freedom of Information Act to, that they released these 87 photos and these four videotapes taken at Abu Ghraib by a Army specialist. Now, the ones that we've seen so far were pretty horrible. When I was in Havana, I went to Cuba in February, at the American Interest section, which they don't have, you know, we don't have an embassy there, but we have this huge building, one of the only kind of fenced in, we have big wrought iron fences and all that, the American Interest section. So what the Cubans did was put up these enormous billboards, bigger than most of the billboards we see, of all these photographs of Abu Ghraib. So whenever you looked out the window, rather than seeing the Malecón, this beautiful ocean-side road in downtown Havana, that the Americans would look out and they'd see these pictures of people being bitten by dogs or that guy that's up on, you know, with the hood on and the wires on. Anyways, be that what it may. So the ACLU says, well, we want these photographs. The American people have the right to see these videotapes. Now, senior Pentagon officials, on the other hand, they say that this would incite public opinion in the Muslim world and put the lives of American soldiers and officials at risk. And this according to the chairman of the Joint Chiefs of Staff, Richard B. Myers. He says that it could cause riots, violence, and attacks by insurgents that would result if these images were released. Now, I know this is going to be hard for you to believe, but I tend to think this might not be the best thing to do. I mean, you could argue me out of it. I mean, these things happen. But given the fact that a lot of what's been instigated, and you got to remember that there's a small, teeny percentage of young Muslim men that are willing to act out the kind of frustration and hatred and desire for revenge that comes with seeing what's being done by the West in their homeland, the Middle East. So I guess I would hesitatingly say maybe this stuff does not have to be shown or shouldn't come out. The descriptions are one thing, but do they need to be seen? You answer me, 313-298-WRIF. By the way, that no one other than the low-level people that actually perpetrated these horrors at Abu Ghraib have ever been punished. And none of the commanding officers, and I don't want to go on endlessly with this, but the people that were in charge, the people that did not exercise full supervision, the ones that when you realize what the kind of permission that was given, are ultimately responsible for their subordinates. Because if there would have been rules, you don't do anything harmful to anyone, this wouldn't have occurred on the base, on the mass basis that it did. On the other hand, you got a four-star general, Kevin B. Burns, who was dismissed as the head of Army Training and Doctrine Command for having continued, for adultery. I mean, this sounds like, a religious country. They said he was having adultery. This guy was separated from his wife, but he was seeing somebody else, and they still called it adultery. So, and this guy is cashiered out of the armed forces. Figure that one. All right, 313-298-WRIF is our phone number. I'd like to hear from you. And calltalkyes@yahoo.com if you'd like to email me. And let's see. Let's go to Ed. Ed, thanks for waiting so long. You're on the air. Go ahead.
Hey, thanks. How you doing, Peter?
Doing great. Shut off your radio, please.
Okay. I was doing a little research, and I went to your homepage, and through one of your links on Truth Out, I brought up a story, and it's from it was written by Henry Waxman, the ranking minority leader.
Yeah, of the in the House of Representatives. Yeah.
Yes, and he's writing to Dennis Hastert about legislation being put into the energy bill after the gavel had been struck.
Uh-huh.
and it's a $1.5 billion provision benefiting oil and gas companies in Halliburton and Sugarland, Texas.
Sure.
Now, this is Tom DeLay's district. Now, he brought it to his attention on, this would be on July 27th. Well, they turned around and voted on it. And in the August 7th Sunday edition of the Detroit Free Press, it has in here that they actually put the provision in, voted on it, and passed it, even uh-huh. though it was brought to their attention prior to the vote.
Yeah, well, this energy bill was a scam, and I don't know, did Democrats vote for that? I didn't notice the vote, because you've got these, you know, like these 15 Democrats that voted for the Central American Free Trade bill, which is, yeah, just doing the dirty work of the Republicans.
Basically. I guess a couple of the Democrats did shift that said they weren't going to vote for it, turned around and did vote for it,
mm-hmm.
which, if they hadn't, it might not have passed.
Yeah, yeah. So where's the opposition party?
Yeah,
there isn't one.
Which side are they on?
Yeah.
You know? You were expressing earlier that... people are frustrated and don't really know what to do.
Yeah.
I kind of think what a good thing to do would be, like, try a National Strike Friday type of thing, where on Fridays everybody just calls in sick to work and stays home.
That's another great...
with their family.
Yeah, that's another great European tradition, the general strike. Not just striking one little company or anything like that. Gas prices, not only are we not going to spend a dime on gas on a particular Friday, but we're also all going to stay home from work. General strike till you get the gas prices down below $2. Because these corporations do not have to make these extravagant profits. I mean, this is capitalism, so they're going to make some profits, but they don't have to do it at our expense. They couldn't care less. All right, Ed, thank you very much. Appreciate your input. Thanks for calling 313-298-WRIF. Rolling Stones just starting their tour. Is it just one day? I know they actually did a small club date. They tend to do that in Toronto. Then they opened the big stadiums in Boston, and they're on their way to Detroit. They're going to play Comerica Park, isn't it? Yeah. And they've got a lot of new songs out, including one, is it Rough? Yeah, Rough Justice. It's a great little song. But they've got another one called My Sweet Neocon. My Sweet Neocon. And the line is, how come you're so wrong, my sweet neocon? And what? Get these lyrics. This is Mick, Sir Mick, we should call him, singing. And this is for real. You call yourself a Christian. I call you a hypocrite. You call yourself a patriot. Well, I think you're full of rhymes with hypocrite. How come you're so wrong, my sweet neocon? What if we're going to play it? You know, there's a couple of people here. I debated for a long time whether or not to call their names out that actually still have Bush bumper stickers on their car. So I told them, we had a big staff meeting about high definition, HD radio, about HD radio, the future of radio. And we're broadcasting in HD radio, by the way. And so I jokingly said that I wanted to save them the humiliation of still going around with a Bush bumper sticker on their big old trucks. Get that. War for oil. They're driving something that's getting 9 miles a gallon. And they said they didn't appreciate that, though. And so I didn't. I would never do that. Although, wasn't there? Oh, yeah. There was an Air Force officer, a U.S. Air Force colonel, charged with painting obscenities on parked cars bearing pro-President Bush stickers. This was in Colorado Springs, Colorado. And he was at the National Security Space Institute there. And he was, where was this, in Denver, I guess it was. And so he was finding these cars with pro-Bush bumper stickers on, parked at the airport, and then he would spray paint over the bumper sticker with an expletive, as they say here. Don't do that. Don't do that. If you're on the left, that's what the right wing does. They're the ones that rip down signs. They're the ones that pull up lawn signs. They're the ones that that want to interfere with the free expression of speech. So it's kind of funny when you get that an Air Force colonel is painting obscenities on cars with Bush bumper stickers on it, but not good to do. Doesn't win any converts like that, and not appropriate for people that that believe in freedom. All right, here's Adam in Belleville. Adam, it's Peter Werby. Thanks for calling.
Hi. Earlier, I talked to you, and I only got half my half what I had to say out.
Well, wait. We don't come back twice, Adam, and sometimes I have to cut these things short, so I'm sorry about that. Yeah, you only get the call once, so hold on with that, please. Here's Chris in Oakland. Chris, Peter Werby, go ahead.
Yes, you guys were talking about fuels earlier and hydrocarbon-based fuels, and that out in the Midwest, what's really becoming popular is that flex fuel that they're using that's like, 70% alcohol, I think. And they're actually already here in the state of Michigan.
Really?
I have a friend that has one. It's as simple as reprogramming the computer in the vehicle, because that's what I do every day for a living. I'm a mechanic. And we come up with a problem one day where we needed a part, and we found out his vehicle was a flex fuel vehicle, that it runs on that 70% mixture, or it could.
Tell me a little more. I haven't heard the term flex fuel.
Yes, it's either a 50-50 gas to alcohol mixture, or it's like 70% alcohol to 30% gasoline. They run it out in corn country out in the Midwest.
Really?
And we have one right here in the little town of Leonard, Michigan, where I live. And I went to put a fuel filter on it one day and found out it was the wrong part. And I went out to buy this part that normally is a $14 part. It cost me $84 at the dealer at my boss's cost to fix this car. And then we also found out after the fact that it had a 100,000-mile warranty on it. So we're running it still. And I'd like to try the flex fuel itself. I know up in Midland, because I used to work up in that neighborhood, that the used to be the Total Refinery. They make 100% ethanol mixture up there. So, I mean, it's not like the government doesn't know that we can't take and create alcohol fuels and run cars on what they call flex fuel now, which is safer to the environment than anything if
sure.
you want to go that side of it.
Sure, and I was just reading on Yahoo News. I should have saved it. I didn't. About a guy that took his Prius, his, what do you call those things, a hybrid, and retrofitted it. He spent $3,000 more on it, but he's getting 80 miles a gallon.
Yeah.
Yeah. So it can be done. All right, Leonard, Michigan, nice town. Thanks a lot. Appreciate it, Chris. Yeah, the other fossil fuel that Bush is committed to, another thing that's just, again, basis of wars and so destructive to the planet that it makes oil look benevolent. And of course, that's nuclear power. Just when you thought it was gone, and of course, it's never gone. Nuclear power is forever. Now, a federal court ruled over a year ago that there was a standard for this Yucca Mountain. That's in Nevada. And all this waste that these nuclear power plants create, like the Fermi 2 down in Monroe, Michigan, it has to go somewhere. Right now, most of it is just sitting outside. It's being stored. And they're gonna, and because the government has promised it's going to find a permanent, get this word, permanent repository for all this waste that some of it has half-life of like 250,000 years. Now, remember, 10,000 years ago, a short 10,000 years ago, there weren't cities. We were all tribal people. All of us, Euro-Americans, all of us white people, we were no different than the people in Africa and, in fact, in many ways, less civilized. So, anyway. That's something else. But so that was 10,000 years ago. So the Environmental Protection Agency under Bush said, well, you got to keep it safe for 10,000 years. And they said, 10,000? That's nothing. This stuff just lasts and lasts. So now the EPA has revised its health standard for the proposed nuclear waste storage at Yucca to limit radiation releases for 1,000,000 years. Okay, we've got, I mean, that's insane. There weren't any people 1,000,000 years ago. There were dinosaurs. So this is this fuel that has to be kept safe and away from people, and they have nothing go wrong with it, not have any accidents for 1,000,000 years. Even 10,000 years is insane. And every minute that these plants continue, and remember, Bush wants more of them, that there's more waste created. Where is, let me see, I thought I had more on here. Oh, yeah, see page two. Lamar Walters, chairman of the Beatty, Nevada. They're 20 miles away from Yucca Mountain. And both the Republicans and the Democrats, by the way, talk about bipartisanship. The Republican senator, the Democratic senator, all the officials there, everybody. Nevada says, we do not want the country's waste. We do not want Michigan's nuclear waste. We don't want Fermi 2's dangerous radioactive waste in our mountain. And, of course, it has to be transported across the country. So don't have an accident. Don't let any terrorists get it. You getting the idea that there's a problem here? Anyways, Lamar Walters, chairman of the BD Advisory Board, he said that he'd spoken to about Yucca Mountain, and he said they're comfortable with 10,000-year standard. On the other hand, Alpheus Bruton, owner of the BD Club, a bar, said that though he felt comfortable with the shorter standard, how can he feel sad? He was surprised that the environmental agency could be so sure about a standard 100 times longer. He says, I just can't imagine how the EPA can guarantee anything for a million years, including whether the Earth will still be here. To say anything is going to be good for a million years is preposterous. It is. So the government, George Bush's EPA, is being preposterous. Absolutely preposterous.
WRIF.com. WRIF. Peter will be right back with more of your calls right after this.
I'm really behind on my bills. I do own my home, but my credit isn't exactly perfect.
Those high-interest credit cards are ruining me. Is there anything I can do to get out of debt?
We need that loan now. Are we ever going to get our cash?
Tired of playing games? Call American Equity Mortgage at 888-229-7699 for the right answer. Yes.
American Equity Mortgage said yes. Even with less than perfect credit, I got the cash I needed.
American Equity Mortgage said yes. I'm saving hundreds of dollars every month.
American Equity Mortgage said yes. We closed in 1 week. Say yes to a loan from American Equity Mortgage, and we'll say yes to you. Call toll-free, 888-229-7699. American Equity Mortgage, open till 8, 888-229-7699, or apply online at americanequity.com.
It's party time. Get a real feel of erotic image featuring Michigan's hottest male and female strippers.
Erotic image.
Add a stripper to any party and watch your party come alive.
Erotic Image Strippers delivers the sexiest and most seductive entertainers right to your doorstep.
For your next bachelor, bachelorette, birthday, or any party occasion, give the gift that unwraps itself. Call Erotic Image Strippers at 888-41-STRIP.
Explore Erotic Image at eroticimage.com, the official home of the Erotic Image Dream Girls, the incredible hunks of Men in Motion, and those naughty, awesome twosomes, the wild, girly girls. Turn your party into a bash and try a party appetizer to kick off your next gathering. Their costumed host, hostess, and bartenders will cater to your guest of honor and dazzle your party. Now at Erotic Image, male and female models for any and all events.
Call, click, or visit the Erotic Image Cyber Showcase. View Erotic Image's strippers, check their prices, and place your order online.
Call Erotic Image at 888-41-STRIP. That's 888-41-STRIP.
Erotic Image, where image is everything.
Dear Mr. H, Mr. Two, and Mr. O, it's time for us to become reacquainted, to break out the suits and the towels. Time to dive into every day and every cooler filled with the signature taste of Budweiser. Right, crisp, clean, and pure. You guys are making the water, and we're jumping in.
I'm looking up, oh, sun is hanging high. I gotta move, if I don't, I'm gonna fry. I hit the water and my worries drift away. I think it's gonna be a great, great day. Ooh, I'm ready. Ooh, bring it on.
Budweiser Beer, Anheuser-Busch, St. Louis, Missouri.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much. Welcome back to our final segment. It goes right up till 1 a.m. and then a couple of interviews. One about Founding Father Thomas Paine. People are like, oh, man, that'll be interesting. Yeah, I like that stuff. Doesn't sound real interesting. It's a good interview. I wouldn't put it on if it wasn't. And then a repeat performance from Elwood Reed, an incredible writer. He did a fictionalized version of D.B., D.B. Cooper, the guy that took all this money, jumped out of a plane about 30 years ago, kind of a legend up in the northwest part of the country. Incredible book, too. Let's see. We were talking earlier, quite a bit earlier, with Barry Crimmins, who was reporting from Crawford, Texas, about Cindy Sheehan. And I asked him, wasn't Nugent down there, Ted Nugent? So Bob writes into calltalkyes@yahoo.com. I just wanted to let you know that Nugent did move to Crawford. He bought a ranch near Bush. Also, the local papers have been floating the rumor that he's going to run against Governor Granholm here in Michigan. Maybe he's being schooled in Karl Rove methodology. And let's strike. What that means is, we were talking earlier about the only way that we're going to stop this assault on our standard of living is put up some kind of resistance. The old-fashioned general strike might be cool. That's Have there ever been a general strike in the United States? There have been some general strikes in cities, in Toledo, this is back in the 30s, San Francisco, Minneapolis. Who's this now? Butch from Hadley. He says, hey, Pete, I wonder if the oil tanker is still cruising the seas that Condoleezza Rice's former employer named after her for being such a good oil baroness. Great show. We've been listening since I called in and talked to Judge Wapner some 20 years ago. I don't remember. Did I interview him? I guess I did. Yeah, there's an oil tanker, the Condoleezza Rice. Isn't that nice? And that's who's operating our foreign policy. Of course, she only takes into account the needs of U.S. citizens, not the oil companies that have the tanker named after her. Gene writes in, as I understand it, the rest of the world has seen those pictures. Oh, yeah, these are the Abu Ghraib pictures that I said that I tended to agree with the government, with the military chiefs, who said, releasing these photos aren't going to do any good and might hurt us. They might inflame Muslim public opinion when they see what the invaders of their part of the world, and specifically Iraq, have done. So I said, maybe it is best that we could get a description of them. I don't want to ever suppress any words. But so apparently, according to Gene, that the world has already seen these. He says, I believe that not releasing the pics will only show our cowardice and inflame the Muslim world anyway. I think we should release the pictures to acknowledge our wrongs. After all, the first step to change is acknowledging flaws. Well, Bushko never admits anything. Ben, listening in Ann Arbor, says, tell people that if we use ethanol rather than gasoline, we make the American farmer, we give the American farmer our money, not oil kingpins in the Middle East or here in the United States. This is what I said to a family member who had to vote on having an ethanol plant built in their community. Give the money to the farmer who used the money he made from selling his corn to buy a Ford truck, thus keeping the assembly line and food on our table. All right, 313-298-WRIF is our phone number, and here is Curtis. Curtis is calling in from Algonac. Hi, Curtis.
Hey.
Hey.
Yeah, I'm calling from Algonac.
Yeah.
And I was wondering if when you guys started doing songs again, if you could play.
Oh, man. No. All right. All of that, all you have to do is give an opinion. I'm not seeing Next on here, so I think we're having those problems again. Dave from Livonia. Hey, Dave. It's Peter. You're on the air.
Hi, Pete. How you doing?
Doing great. Thanks.
Good. Pete, I got just a couple of comments. First thing is, if everybody is really so concerned about the oil prices and everything, there's a couple of things we can do.
What's that?
Let's get rid of our boats, and because they're gas hogs, and everybody knows that.
Sure.
And second of all, I haven't heard anybody call in that knows the actual price to produce a gallon of gas from oil, crude. So if I could hear somebody tell me what it costs to produce a gallon of gasoline from, let's say, a gallon of crude, or 5 gallons or 10 gallons, whatever, then I would tend to believe that it's overpriced. Until I hear that, I got to go with, you know, the market value.
Well, there's a couple things that strike me. Yeah, that would be interesting. I mean, we know that there's been a sharp increase in the in the profits of, like, ExxonMobil. So it's not just that the per the price per barrel has gone up, they're making profits above and beyond that. In other words, if it went up equal, all right, so it's $30 and it's a dollar and a half. Well, I don't think I can do all this math. But if it went up, I can't remember what the phrase, arithmetically, I guess, or, you know, as the oil went up, the price went up equally. But the price of it is going up much more than the cost. And so what else could explain how they're making such huge profits?
Well, I don't know. I mean, I'm not one in the oil industry, but I guess I'd have to ask that question, though. You know, I mean, just how much does it cost?
Okay, that's a decent question.
And, you know, you and I all like to make a decent living. And
sure.
And I think they would, too. So I guess I'd like to see the numbers. But
well, wait a minute. There's a difference between a decent living, which most people we know make, and an obscene living, which means that they make extraordinary profits off of, A, the misery of lots of other people, which now includes a war, and secondly, the destruction of the planet. So they want to make way beyond a decent living. All right, thank you very much. Appreciate your call. And you know what I can't do? I said I was going to talk about Costco, and it's too long. But Costco makes a decent living for its stockholders and for its owners, and pays people real well. I mean, this is an extraordinary article. Let me see. When was it? July 17th, I've been carrying this thing around because we keep talking about this war. We have to. How can we not talk about something where people in our country are getting killed and people in our country are killing other people? You know, you can't ignore this. But ultimately, it's all about what's the economy about? How's it affecting us? What are we getting back for our work? Why do we get so little when we work so hard compared to other industrial nations? But I guess maybe next week. All right, I don't see next on here, Jay, so what I'm going to do is I'm just going to take the people that have been hanging on the longest. Doesn't that make sense? I know some of you think that's what it is, but the job of a producer is to get a flow to the show. So sometimes you might wind up, you know, I know it's not fair, but it's radio, so it's not fair. All right. It's Alan Engster. Hi, Al. It's Peter Werby. Al, run to the phone.
I'm on the phone.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air.
I want to talk about oil prices because it's just what the other caller said before, you know. He's right. Everybody wants to make a living, but the oil companies are getting outrageously wealthy off my back.
Sure.
I've got a small car. When I bought it, I could fill it up for $8.
Uh-huh.
When I filled it up the last time, I paid $28, and when I filled it up last week, I paid $8 more, $36 to fill it up. And that's obscene.
Yeah, it is. I mean, I have to say, I had a choice between getting a car that got better mileage than the one that I got. And I thought, I like this. It's a, you know, it's a domestic car. In fact, I think at the time I was working for the UAW, and I thought, I better not. Yeah. I mean, they don't even let you park in their lot if you have a foreign car. So I had a, I can't remember what it is. What, a Nissan, not Avanti. What are they? I don't know.
Sentra?
No, a little upscale from that. Not a lot, though. Anyways, so I couldn't even park in their lot. I had to park on the street. So, so I got a big three car. And so now I'm paying for it at the pump.
As am I, but I've got a foreign car, and we're still paying. Everybody's paying.
Yeah, you paid $36 to fill up a foreign car?
VW Bug.
Huh. Well, I'm not going to go to the VW Bug. I had one of those when I was 21. All right, Al, thanks. I appreciate it. All right, here is Douglas from Chesterfield. Hey, you're on the air.
All right, Al, thanks. I appreciate it. All right.
Hey, turn your radio off. Damn.
Hey, Peter.
Yeah, turn your radio off. Okay, you got it. Can't you hear this phone on? Can't you hear the show on hold?
Yeah, I just walked in the other room.
Okay, go ahead. You're on the air.
Okay, I just wanted to call about the guy that called about the flex fuel.
Yeah.
I don't want to mention any names because I don't want to get anyone in trouble, but I do know someone that did work in a lab in one of the major automotive manufacturers, and they did come up with a alcohol based fuel, but he said it wasn't mixed with gasoline. He said it was mostly alcohol and water. And it would end up being like, I don't know, like 10, 15 cents a gallon.
Wow.
And it worked, and they worked on this for months, him and another guy in the lab. And then the day they came up with it and came up with the results and proved that it worked, they went into work the next day. Everything was gone. All the computers, all the files, everything. And they said, you've been reassigned.
Huh.
So I'm like, what? Are they hiding something? What's going on?
Well, there certainly isn't any real drive to increase fuel economy, nor to develop fuels that would be less harmful to the environment and would be cheaper. Because we go back to the one caller. You said decent living. They don't want to make a decent living. They want to have an extravagant living. And of course, you and I wind up paying for their extravagance.
Yeah, we're punished for. I don't understand this.
If the problem is that if you let people to their own resources not to their own resources, their own sort of ethical drive. Under this system, the greed comes out, and people, like in the 19th century, where they made workers work 12 and 14 hours a day, 6 and 7 days a week. They had little kids working in factories. They were totally unsafe, and these were people that were the pillars of the community. They were the rich and powerful, the pious and the pompous. Where did I get that from? Oh, that's actually my guest was talking about that. These were the upper class, the ruling class, the people, the economic elite. And it was only through the intervention of government on one hand, but mostly because people began to rise up in movements of resistance and say, we're not going to work 7 days a week. We're not going to work 12 hours a day. The 8-hour day, which was in the 1880s, people were agitating for the 8-hour day. And the cops shot down people in the street in Chicago because they wanted an 8-hour day. So the resistance to letting the average person have a decent living, at one free from massive exploitation, is hard to come by. And we can just eat it continually. And then they look at us. They say, well, maybe we ought to repeal these laws on child labor. Because, hey, some of these poor families have all been cut off of welfare. I bet they'd like to have their 9-year-olds working in, an auto plant. And probably something a 9-year-old could do there. So it's a race to the bottom. That's what's happening with all these, for instance, these international trade agreements that are happening. All right, thanks a lot. I appreciate your call. So you can say, they are so awful to us. Our masters are bad. Our rulers are unfair. Well, that's the nature of masters and of rulers. And if we're willing to be slaves, if we're willing to be the ruled, well, we're just going to have to get whatever we take. We can hope we get nice masters. We can hope we get nice rulers, but sure doesn't look like it's going that way at all, does it? Here's Pat in St. Clair. St. Clair Shores. Hi, Pat.
Hello.
Hi, Pat.
Hello.
Hear
me?
Yeah, I can hear you. Hi, Pat.
How are you doing tonight, Peter?
Doing good.
Hey,
what's up?
Last caller there just was hitting on what I kind of wanted to talk about a little bit there.
What's that?
About the water and alcohol mix with the gasoline.
Uh-huh.
Now, I live in, St. Clair is where I live.
I don't know
if you've ever been up that way.
Sorry. Yeah, I'm not St. Clair. That's on the St. Clair River.
Yeah.
Yeah, nice town.
Well, very nice. Now, the water table throughout the Great Lakes has dropped tremendously over the past few years. I don't know if you guys ever heard you talk to all these different callers, ever making gas with water?
Make gas with what?
Water.
Gas from water. No? Hydrogen fuel.
Yeah. Well, I don't know. You see a lot of these freighters come through town all the time, in and out. And since they had the problems in the waterways there with the ocean crustaceans, they had the zebra mussels, and they had other problems with other different outside, saltwater fish
yeah.
in the Great Lakes. Well, they made them.
Wait. Now, let me just stop you 1 second. We have people listening all around the country and all around the world, and they might not recognize some of what you're talking about. We're talking about zebra mussels, like a little biped, or not biped, whatever the hell it is. You know, these little, like, clamps, and they're striped, so they call them zebra mussels. And when he's talking about freighters going through town, he's talking about these huge Great Lake freighters that go from Lake Superior to Lake Huron, and then down the St. Clair River. So when he says freighters coming through town, he's talking, it's not like, you know, going through the main street, but down the waterway. I'm sorry, I'm just clearing it up for you.
Yeah, they're going through the local rivers and the channels.
Right.
Well, anyhow, they started making them for bilges. They made them empty everything out when they were coming from salt water in the two locks up in the UP. And so they wouldn't have that problem anymore. Well, so now when they were leaving, they would, you know, dump their coal at the Edison or wherever, whatever they were carrying, their cargo, they would empty it. And when they were leaving, they were filling their bilges full of fresh water.
Okay.
Now, as though, as everybody's crying and the complain anymore, is, oh, the water table is dropped tremendously. Well, now the water is probably 4.5 feet lower than it used to be in the area.
Well, I thought last winter there was you know, enough snowpack and that had gone up some. But no, I guess you're right. Overall, the lake levels have gone down, which is kind of disturbing. I know that, like, in the late 1980s, or in the mid-1980s and late 1980s, there was fear that the lakes actually were rising. People's property was getting eroded, like on Lake Michigan and what have you.
Yeah, but...
Now it's down.
This is just my personal theory of it myself. I mean...
Wait, you think that the reason that the lakes are down is because these freighters are taking on lake water?
Yeah, exactly.
I don't know, man. I think it's a lot to do with climate stuff. In other words, if you don't have ice on the Great Lakes, there's a lot of evaporation. You need you want an ice cover on. And the other thing is global warming, which means that the winters are warmer, and then you don't get enough snow, so you don't get enough snowpack that runs off. I don't think those freighters could take up that much, but it's interesting. I'll be up your way one of these days. Maybe what's the restaurant right there? Crab, something with crab in it. River Crab. The River Crab Restaurant. That's right. Here's Howard in Grass Lake, Michigan. Howard, you're on the air. Go ahead.
Hi, Pete.
Hi.
Regarding that fuel you're talking about, it's an M85 is what they designated as. It's 85% ethanol mixed with gasoline.
Okay.
They ran a lot of it about 10 years ago, and it's kind of faded away.
Really? How come?
Yeah, I don't know. I work for Chrysler, and they just kind of quit doing any work on it. We do have cars that will run on it yet, but there's not really any development going on.
Huh.
The other thing I called about is you keep talking about, you know, there's no weapons of mass destruction in Iraq. Got a correction for you.
What's that?
A weapon. We've taken depleted uranium over there. And the whole country over there, along with the Balkans, is contaminated and will be for eons. I don't know if you've got much research on that or not.
Let me do this, Howard. You must be on a cell phone because it's breaking up. So let me just say goodbye, and I'll talk a little about that. What he said was there are weapons of mass destruction, and that's depleted uranium. We've talked about this some. Depleted uranium is what they use to harden armor and to harden shells. And when it's constituted, like, for instance, if we had a shell of depleted uranium sitting here, it wouldn't even set off a Geiger counter. You fire it, and then you hit something, and it atomizes, it pulverizes, then you have this dust in the air. And there's been increased cancer rates wherever this has been used among, I don't know, I've actually seen it mostly among British troops, but he said in the Balkans when it was used as well. So that's if there's those kind of weapons, they've been brought there. Here's Alex in Livonia. Alex, hi, it's Peter Werby. You're on the air.
Hey there, Pete.
Hi.
I'm calling to talk about gas prices. I don't like to be labeled as a conservative or liberal or anything. I'm not really that political, but I kind of go on common sense, and I had environmental science with my degree at college, and for one thing, I don't like to see a lot of blame given on one person or administration, you know, Bush blaming him for oil prices or things like that. I kind of submit to you that this current situation with oil and the gas prices could be under any president, you know. I mean, it was pretty bad under Carter, for example. I was too young at the time. But
when prices went up.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Well,
yeah.
You tell me. I was too young at the time, but were like the Republicans blaming Carter for the gas prices and things like that. So I think it's kind of tough to just put it all on the current acting president. You know, things seem to always end up on his shoulders, so I can understand that, like the decision to go to war. Totally.
Well, yeah, but, I mean, here's a guy that's really tied in with the oil companies. And, yeah, maybe Carter, I can't remember it all exactly, maybe deserved the criticism. It's possible. I mean, why didn't Carter or why doesn't Bush introduce legislation that controls profits from oil? I mean,
well,
there's nothing in the Constitution says you can't do that.
I'm not even so sure that we're so bad off. I mean, we're not even near price adjusted for inflation, how much the gas was during the 70s crisis. So we've always been known, we've always had the best, cheapest oil in the world. So, I mean, we could have used a little raising and it'd be pretty much natural as far as I would, commonsensically. You know,
well, here's what I mean, I've heard that argument a lot. Here's the problem with it. Gas, they always say, well, gas in Italy is like $6 a gallon. People don't drive the miles that we do, and it's not just for pleasure, but the nature of this culture that's been constructed for us. In other words, the ordinary person was never asked, do you want to have you know, a city where you have to drive everywhere? This was just kind of what we were given. So, and we were told we could have these big cars. And so now, you know, when all of a sudden, in order to do this, we're going to have to start paying exorbitant amounts. I don't think that's too fair. All right, I have to go, unfortunately, but thank you for your last call. A few things here. James from is listening in Kenosha, Wisconsin, writes, although sailors considered a bad omen to rechristen a ship, in April 2001, Chevron renamed Condoleezza Rice's ship as the Altair Voyager. All gratitude to Cindy Sheehan, he writes, for providing a voice for many Americans opposed to the war. Hopefully, the momentum that is building will snowball towards September 24th in Washington, where there's going to be a massive anti-war demonstration. I hope lots of you go. I have some problems, but I'm going to try to get there. Talking about releasing these torture photos of from Abu Ghraib with U.S. Soldiers torturing Iraqi prisoners. Doug writes from Trabuco Canyon, California. The graphic pictures of torture need to be shown for nothing more than to make the war cheerleaders of this nation admit that it happened. Without the pictures, they will keep up the denial. We're never going to make it right, and we're never going to make right what we have done wrong until we own up to it. All right, thanks a lot for all your calls and for listening to this segment of the show. Please stay tuned. I have a couple of very interesting interviews to follow.
You're listening to WRIF.com.
On WRIF. Peter will be right back with another guest right after this.
When my son started having behavior problems, the total transformation techniques were like the instruction manual on how to deal with him. We got immediate results.
Ever wish your kid came with an instruction manual when he's disrespectful, defiant, or even abusive? Do you know how to fix it? I'm behavioral therapist James Lehman, and I'll show you how to change your child's behavior right now with the Total Transformation. The program that helps you fix every behavior problem under the sun. Defiance, backtalking, lying, acting out in school, even problems with ADD and ADHD. There's no screaming, no fighting, no frustration. The Total Transformation is the program I've used for over 30 years to solve even the worst behavior problems. Your child will listen to you again, and you'll get peace and sanity back into your home. I guarantee it.
Call now and get How to Turn Your Child's Attitude Around in 1 minute or less free with your order. 1-800-325-2185. 1-800-325-2185. Call now. 1-800-325-2185. 1-800-325-2185.
Hey, Trudy.
Hey, David.
Here we are in August. Seems like a while since we've kind of gotten together on one of these deals.
I know. It's your fault.
I know.
I
take the blame.
Call me.
Mortgage rates still very, very, very low. Interest-only options, no documentation options, and we're very proud of this fact. This is the one I brought you today. Rock Financial helped over 50,000 clients in the first half of 2005 alone either purchase a home or lower their payment.
People living happily ever after because of Rock Financial.
Over 50,000. We want to do way more the second half of this year, so we want to encourage people to call whether they're purchasing a home, refinancing, they need to consolidate debt, they just want to know what kind of equity they have in their home, or better understand their credit score.
And don't sweat it, because the experts at Rock Financial can help you through this.
10 minutes on the phone can save you thousands over the life of your loan.
Hotline them at 800-333-ROCK, or visit them online at rockfinancial.com if you're that kind of person. Rock Financial is a Quicken Loans company, equal housing lender, and call them today. 800-333-ROCK.
It's kind of like a bat phone.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's a rock phone.
Yeah.
Okay, so how do you want to spend your summer? Listening to some stuffy professor droning on and on about the fall of the Roman Empire? Right! Hey, this is Screaming Scott Randall from 101 WRIF. I love going to work every day. A lot of that is because of my time at the Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts. It's the place to start. Specs Howard teaches you everything you need to get started in radio, television, audio and video production, and so much more. Get hands-on experience. Spend a morning behind the microphone, spinning music, and hosting your own show. Design a lighting set for your class talk show. Write a script. Run a camera. Learn to edit. Direct a program. Just tour the school, and you'll see that a career in broadcasting is never dull, and neither will your time be at Specs Howard. Call them at 248-358-9000 from now through August 31st. Check out the school and all they have to offer to begin a career that you can be excited about. Classes are forming now. Morning, afternoon, and evening options are available. The Specs Howard School of Broadcast Arts in Southfield, Michigan. 248-358-9000. This is where you start. It's where I started.
Since their recent formation, As Cities Burn has shared the stage with everyone from Norma Jean to As I Lay Dying. Based out of Baton Rouge, As Cities Burn combines spacey metal riffs with hardcore breakdowns, layered underneath soaring melodies and guttural screaming. One part metal, one part hardcore. This band has earned their reputation the old-fashioned way, through relentless touring and great songwriting. For fans of Under Oath and The Bled, stop by any DMRC location and pick up As Cities Burn. The DMRC are Record Time in Ferndale, Rockabilly's in Utica, Switched On in Novi, Discs and Tapes Unlimited in Howell, Culture Clash in Toledo, Record Time in Roseville, and The Rock Box in Southgate. All stores are members of the Detroit Music Retailers Collective. Be independent, shop independent.
We're back with more Night Call on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure to be with you. You know, foundation documents, whether it's of a religion or even of a political system, are what people go to for definitions of how life should be lived. The only problem with foundation documents is they're seemingly always open for interpretation. Whose do you believe? I mean, certainly when we look at the major religions and the splits they've had, and they've just got one book, maybe it's written a little differently, and certainly other religions experience the same thing. Well, one document seems sort of, our document, the U.S. Constitution, seems to be invariable. I mean, but again, we found out over the years that can be interpreted any number of ways. Freedom of the press, what can we publish? Freedom of speech or separation of church and state, how's that to be interpreted? And much of it is, at least contemporarily, is done through us attempting to see all of that through the eyes of the founding fathers. Well, there's an extraordinary man who was one of the founding fathers. I suspect most of you listeners will know who he is when I mention his name, but I just came across an extraordinary book about him. The book is called Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, and the author is Harvey J. Kay. He's professor of social change and development at the University of Wisconsin at Green Bay, and also an award-winning author and editor. He's written many books, and they include Are We Good Citizens? And The American Radical. Harvey Kay, welcome to the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
I should have continued my studies. A professor of social change. I'm there.
That's good. I'd like to think we were all there, but that's what we've got to work for.
Now, you mentioned in your book, Promise of America, the book about Thomas Paine, that there was a biography already by 1860 What occurs that we need another? What, in other words, sort of, what was your motivation for doing another Thomas Paine biography?
Okay, well, and I don't take this the wrong way. It's not exactly a biography.
No, I know.
Oh, okay. So, but it's a biography and it's a book about his memory and legacy. Actually,
right.
If I could tell you a story.
Sure, please.
Okay, I became interested in Thomas Paine as a boy. I was about 5, 6, 7, 8, 9, 10. However, you know, somewhere in there. And my grandparents lived in Brooklyn, New York. And whenever they didn't want me in the room when we would be visiting them, they would start speaking in Yiddish. And what that meant was they would leave the room. We have serious business to talk about. And I'd wander the apartment as if it was a museum. And in one of the corners of the dining room, my grandfather kept some personal books. He was a trial lawyer, and all his law books were in the office. And on this one particular shelf, there were several books by and about Thomas Paine, one of which was truly outrageous, but it caught my imagination as a kid, and it argued that Thomas Paine was the real author of the Declaration of Independence. And every year in school, willing to get that one wrong on a test or look like a fool in the class, I would make that argument, because it showed a little, you know, showed some insight, you know, that America wasn't just about the founders we all talked about. And so he, all my life, Thomas Paine had been my hero, knowing full well he was not the author of the Declaration. And in the 1990s, I wrote a young adult biography of Thomas Paine, because I figured if we're going to get him to read, we're going to get him young, right? It's the only way to make it happen. And when I finished writing that book, I thought, you know, I do not want to give up this intimate relationship with Thomas Paine. I got to do something.
Mm-hmm.
So I said to we were out walking in the woods, and I said to my wife, you know, no one's ever really told the story of how Paine shaped America. We, you know, most people know he, you know, pushed for independence, but they don't know the degree to which he really shaped what it means to be an American. And they also had never really told the story that everyone just assumed. The assumption was that the conservatives had suppressed his memory for 200 years, and so he had been a forgotten founding father.
On the other hand, he's often cited, like by Reagan, as you indicated.
Indeed.
In your book.
In fact, yeah. That was one of the things that led me to ask, why, after 200 years, did somebody on the right start to quote him? So I started doing the research, and what I discovered was he was never forgotten. What I discovered was, as much as the conservatives, well, the powerful, the property, the prestigious, and the highly pious, tried to suppress memory of Paine, that in every generation, free thinkers, abolitionists, working men, labor, socialists, populists, progressives, all the way through the 20th century, in every generation, Paine had been remembered, that radicals had turned to him for inspiration and encouragement. And the more I looked, the more I came to appreciate that by way of common sense and the crisis papers back in 1776, that Paine had not only been the one who first asked us, who first proclaimed that we should proclaim our independence, he actually imbued in American life a radical democratic impulse that has always been a part of us. He really gave the meaning of America a sort of world historic importance. He said, look, you know, I'm going to paraphrase. He said, you know, America is going to start a new age in human history. When Americans get organized and declare their independence, they're going to create a democratic republic, which the world has never seen, and it will begin that new age of history. So I got so into this that it was like, first it was my effort to hold on to Paine in dark times, you might say. But beyond that, it was a question of trying to get my fellow citizens to realize that not only was Paine important, but they carry Thomas Paine's arguments within themselves.
And there's even, you said when we first spoke, when you answered the phone, you were brushing up on your Motown knowledge. Well, it doesn't appear as Thomas Paine visited Detroit, but his spirit visited the young students at the University of Michigan in Ann Arbor with that influence you just spoke
of. Absolutely,
yeah.
Absolutely. The SDS, the founding documents of SDS Port Huron Statement, although Paine's not mentioned, you can hear the echoes of his original common sense and rights of man. Also, also it's the case, even within the UAW in Detroit and elsewhere, Paine's influence is felt. Walter Reuther, as a teenager, apparently wrote essays in high school about Thomas Paine, though maybe not later in life remembered them all the time. But it's definitely the case. Paine's influence spreads across the country, and indeed right through the 1960s and into the 1970s.
Well, Harvey Kay, you used a word which has kind of come into disrepute again, just when it looked like it was going to be okay, and that was the word radical. I mean, I've always thought of, and it's certainly affirmed by your book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, that Paine was the most radical of the founding fathers. And so I think that maybe you could speak to the last part, but also to resuscitate the word radical, because now we just think, you know, radical Shiites, radical Islamists,
right.
And all that. So it sounds like someone whose extremism is way beyond what's necessary and also hurts people.
Yeah, that's a good question. I mean, in fact, even in the book, I refer to liberals, progressives, and radicals to try and encompass the left. I mean, I'll just point out that up until the 1950s, radical always meant someone on the left, and a reactionary with those who were on the right. And so, probably more likely to call them, we should call them reactionary Islamists. We should reclaim the meaning of radicalism as something that's progressive, that's something that's liberating freedom, equality, and democracy. Now, the other thing I wanted to say about this is that we on the left really shouldn't divide ourselves into liberals, progressives, and radicals, into these separate categories. And if you'll excuse my being political here, if we're ever really going to retake America, take back America from the right, we're going to have to start thinking ourselves in a broadly progressive way. And that means, for example, that we're going to have more confidence in our fellow citizens. And I think being a radical would require that. It means we have to have a greater sense of hope about the possibilities that still prevail in this country to bring about social change. And it also means we're going to have to start talking to each other on the left and not merely writing each other off.
But tell me, though, about Paine as being the most radical of the founding fathers.
Oh, well, you see, I'm glad you asked that, in fact. Thanks for reminding me. All the founding fathers, as they came to be called, at some point subscribed to the idea of independence. But Paine was the one who went public on the question. Paine was the one who said, and he'd only been in the country for 1 year as an immigrant, he saw in America tremendous possibilities, and he was the one who said the United States of America should be created as an independent nation based on a republic. But that alone wasn't what made him all that radical. It was radical in that day, but what makes him radical for the ages is the fact that the vision he had of what the United States of America would become was decidedly a democracy in which the power would be in the people, that American citizens would bow to no one, defer to no one, and that part of that involved making sure that there were not extremes of rich and poor. He, in the course of his life, even began, he was the one who actually first envisioned the making of a social security system. He had a plan by which anyone reaching the age of maturity, boy or girl, man or woman, would receive a grant from the government to either get an education, buy property, or set up a business. And that grant would come from taxing the landed rich. And when people said, landed, you're going to tax people to do this? He said he could never understand how people with a lot of money could bear to see people without money.
Huh.
He could never understand how the rich could ever enjoy their lives knowing that nearby there would be those who did not have.
Well, that sounds like a man with conscience. I don't think that ever has bothered the landed rich before. But the country, not that these men were evil by any
no,
but they that's who founded the country were the landed wealthy, and they set it all also up as a slave state. How did Thomas Paine relate to that?
Well, Thomas Paine, almost a year before he called for independence, called for the abolition of slavery. His first major political statement, African Slavery in America, published in the early spring of 1775, asked Americans, how can you speak of the tyranny of Britain? How can you speak of being enslaved by the British Empire when we hold slaves in this country? And he not only demanded an abolition of slavery, and he based it both on reason and on the Bible, he actually said, we have an obligation to make sure that the liberated slaves are able to make it in the world. So he proposed giving them land grants, he proposed giving them education. I mean, he said, look, we have an obligation to end slavery. If we're going to declare ourselves, you know, free people, then we have to make sure we are all free people. He was, in that sense as well, he was a radical, which also scared quite a few of the slaveholders in the South.
My guest on the Peter Werbe Show, Harvey Kay, he is the author of Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, and this is published by Hill and Wang, and there'll be a link on my website to it as well. How did the other founding fathers relate to this radical?
Well, there were those who really liked him, really enjoyed him, who appreciated him. Washington really had an affection for Paine. The one who had the most affection for Paine really, really, truly was Benjamin Franklin. Franklin was the one who gave him the encouragement and gave him a letter of introduction to come to the United States. And Franklin, for the rest of his life, would say that Paine was his adopted political son. Now, there were those others who did not like him. They disdained him, in fact. John Adams had at various times said some of the most evil things about Thomas Paine imaginable. In fact, if you'd like, at some point I can find the quote and read it to you.
Sure.
But in the meantime, let me just say that Adams thought that Paine was really useful in calling for independence, because Adams claimed that he first thought of independence but needed someone else to do it publicly. But what scared Adams was the fact that Paine had such a democratic vision of America. Because while Adams despised aristocracy, he also feared the notion of democracy. A lot of these folks said, well, geez, if we give the right to vote to working people, the first thing they're going to do is vote to get rid of the rest of us, or at least to take our property away.
That's unusual among some of the founding fathers. Was it Hamilton that referred to the people as the great beast?
Yeah, I mean, it was something along those lines. I mean, maybe even worse. A number of them, well, they looked down on the people. I mean, it wasn't that they believed that, you know, that different blood ran in the veins of these folks. They weren't that much aristocrats. But they figured, you know, this was the great, what's the old expression, the great unwashed?
Yeah.
Yeah, and Thomas Paine himself was of the great unwashed. His father was a working man, an artisan back in England. He himself had been an artisan, a teacher, a preacher, a tax collector. He knew what it was to work. He was almost 40 years old before he came to America, and indeed had every kind of experience of a working man. And
well,
when he came to, sorry, go ahead.
I was going to say, how did he get together with the rich and powerful then?
Well, that letter from Franklin was a really powerful introduction. While he was in England, you know, as a young man, Paine, he had met Franklin in what they called the self-taught artisan circles in London. These were men like Paine who had a skill, who had a craft, and they didn't have formal schooling, so they set up their own sort of informal schools at taverns and other places, and they would bring people in to give lectures on anything from glassmaking to astronomy and mathematics. And in those circles, Franklin, who spent a good deal of time in England, is where Paine met him. And when Paine, at 38, 39 years of age, Peter?
Yeah.
Did we lose each other?
No, I think we may have just for a second. I'll see. All right, but as this is, guests always ask me, do we edit this? And a little blip like that, I'm not going to bother to edit. You're listening to the Peter Werby Show, and my guest is Harvey Kay. The book is Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. And as you said, the book is not just a biography of Paine, but rather the influence that he's had. Now, particularly conservatives, but not only, often look to the Federalist Papers to get an understanding of the mindset of the men who put together the United States. Now, Paine was not part of that debate, was he? I don't
know. No. What happened was, after the American Revolution, Paine turned away from politics most of the time, in favor of trying to design an iron bridge. He, like many of the founders, had real interest in science and technology. And in Paine's case, he focused his intellect on the question of how do you unite, how do you build bridges. And in fact, given the bridges of the day, which were wooden, they didn't stand up very well to winter climate, so he designed an iron bridge. But he couldn't find the money to actually build a real working model, or for that matter, beyond that, to build the bridge itself. And Franklin, who was always there for advice, said, it's time for you to go back to London and Paris and see if you can get the capital there. So, in essence, he's in France and in England from about 1787 onward. In fact, so was Jefferson out of the country at the time. Neither one of them were directly involved in the constitutional discussions, but if you imagine a 21st century scene with CNN, you can imagine Paine and Jefferson sitting in Paris in the ambassador's residence watching the CNN reports on the Constitutional Convention. But they didn't have television then, of course. So they would get these letters sent back from America telling them what was going on, and they would sit and discuss, was this a good idea, a bad idea? They both welcomed the Constitution, Paine especially, because he wanted a strong union so that the southern slave states and the New England free states would not break away as they would eventually from each other, as it happened in the Civil War. So between them, they would sit and discuss whether or not the Constitution was a good idea or not. They both, especially Paine, had always said U.S. should have a Constitution, but it should also have a Bill of Rights. So he was a little worried that the Constitution might not include that.
Now, Payne, if my memory serves me correctly from your book, died in 1807.
1809.
1809. What was his final assessment of the United States of America that he had played such a role in bringing about?
Well, even though in certain circles he was scorned by this time, and even though the community that he lived in New Rochelle, New York, even tried to take away his right to vote, you know, these were conservatives up there in New Rochelle, Westchester County, nevertheless, Payne never gave up hope. In fact, he would write, when he came back to America after the French Revolution, he wrote letters to the citizens of the United States reminding them of their responsibilities and of their great possibilities. So never, ever gave up hope. And it's interesting because the reason I said 1809 and didn't let it get by is 1809 is the year in which Lincoln is born. And I think it's interesting to think of Payne dying in 1809 and then Lincoln born in 1809, and Lincoln himself later would be heavily influenced by Payne.
Well, I was going to actually continue the discussion, as you do in your book, about the people that were influenced. And you, at the beginning of the show, had a list, and that included the abolitionists all the way up to student radicals of the 1960s.
Right.
Why does he, I mean, there's so many other people that wrote. Why Payne? What was inherent in Payne that people gravitated to?
Well, probably two things, maybe three things. Okay, the first thing is, let's start at the most basic level. Pick up documents written in the late 18th century. You know, even pick up. You know, who reads the Declaration? Other than that line, you know, all men are created equal. When people go on to read the rest of the Declaration, they practically fall asleep. Try to read the Constitution, which is an important thing to read, but, you know, it's hard getting through. Jefferson, who was such a great writer, even his essays are long, and, you know, you just don't want to do it. Washington, half the time, they weren't even written by him himself. Adams is only fun when you read his letters, but with Payne, there's something else. He writes in a way that not only did it inspire and encourage people of his own day, in other words, not only did they see themselves in his own words as he turned them into Americans instead of Britishers, but it's also the case, if you read Payne today, it's like he's standing there. You can fully understand and appreciate him, especially if you read it aloud like they would have, as they would have done in taverns of the day. So, and people say to me, well, gee, is he such a great writer? And I say, no, think about it this way. He was a great writer, but it's also the case that those words became so much a part of American culture that we actually feel him still within us when we read him. So it's sort of as if it's as if he's always been there. And when you think about every generation of American progressives reaching back to Payne to license and empower their movements, it's not surprising that our American memory is so filled with Thomas Paine, even if not all of us could identify who he was.
Let's go back a little, Harvey Kay, okay, to the idea of radical, because I was thinking in your book, Thomas Paine and the Promise of America, that you describe John Brown and his followers at Harper's Ferry, when they seize Harper's Ferry, reading Thomas Paine, and conservatives say that radical ideas lead to extremist actions. I mean, certainly the loyalists at the time of the American Revolution. I mean, some revolutions are all right if we're doing it, right? The other ones aren't. Go ahead. Just sort
well, first
of,
start. Let's just start with on the premise that writers can never control the impact of their words. We only hope that people read them and try to do something with them. Payne himself abhorred violence, so that probably he would have been shocked by Brown's raid. On the other hand, he would have said, well, slave states. He would have said slavery was, in the long term, decidedly un-American. The United States was predicated on freedom, equality, and democracy as he understood it. And how is it possible that generations later there was still slavery? But he himself despised violence and abhorred it. And he only supported it in favor of progressive causes. So he might have been torn by the John Brown story. But not we shouldn't forget, even in the French Revolution, Payne stood up in the French National Assembly, and though he supported putting the king on trial, of course, he despised monarchy, when the time came to vote on whether or not to behead the king with the guillotine, he stood up and said, no, this would put a blemish on the revolution. We don't want to have this. And he suggested, this is a fascinating answer, he says, let us send the king and his family to America where they can learn about democracy. So, indeed, one doesn't control what happens with one's ideas. I mean, how would Jesus have felt if he had been around for the Inquisition, I always say to people.
There you go. You're a professor of social change at the University of Wisconsin. And do you use Payne's work in your classroom?
Well, I resisted doing it for a long time because it seemed like I would be imposing my ideas, but it got to the point I couldn't resist it. This past semester, I actually offered a course on Thomas Paine and the American Revolution, and the class overflowed in numbers. The students just, in fact, it was very heartening to think that all these students wanted to learn about Thomas Paine, and we had a blast.
Well, as you indicated, what the people over the ages since Paine's life that have been attracted to him have been reformers. Were there conservatives in your class, or was
it
all?
Yes, there were, absolutely. There were, in fact, some Christian evangelical students who felt very torn about things. On the one hand, they were really excited about Thomas Paine. They thought this was truly American. And they were feeling a little guilty about the fact that this very same man was the one who said there should be, not only should there be separation of church and state, which, by the way, evangelicals fought for during the time of the Revolution, and that's why they, at that time, loved Thomas Paine, but also this was the man who said that basically he would have nothing to do with organized religion because he believed that God created the universe, that God created the earth, but God did not intervene. That was what deism was. So these evangelicals, when they would go to talk, and they were on weekends, if they were amongst their brethren, if they were with their ministers, the ministers would be not Thomas Paine, they'd be shocked. But in fact, these students were finding it very interesting.
Now, Paine sounds like he'd be sympathetic to what's pretty controversial now, intelligent design. But I don't know.
Well, you know, I've been thinking about that just the past few days. I've been thinking that.
Well, that's deism, isn't it?
I haven't studied intelligent design enough, and I reject this effort to impose theology in the classroom, frankly. But it's also the case that these very same folks who would talk about intelligent design, I think they would have us next tell us that God will intervene at any moment, and Paine would have nothing to do with that.
Well,
here's what Paine would say.
Go.
Paine would say, look, if God is perfect, and if God's creation couldn't be anything less than perfect, then why would God spend his or her time worrying about the details of everyday life in the world? Okay. In fact, late in his work, he actually talked about the expansion of the universe. And I remember as a teenager reading The Age of Reason, and I thought, wow, what a fascinating idea. The physics professors were telling us the universe expands and contracts and expands, and maybe Paine was onto something.
Age of Reason, when it came out, it was an extraordinary bestseller. I'm remembering everything from your book wrong. How about 150,000 copies? Was that?
150,000 was Common Sense.
Oh, Common Sense. Okay.
I don't have the exact numbers for Age of Reason, but it just, like every one of his writings, it exploded onto the scene and sold in huge numbers. I mean, for young people, you know, ministers and preachers, they were so upset about this heresy. But you know what's funny? The more they preached against it at the time, you can imagine young people grabbing hold of it, just like little kids back when I was a child wanting to read Mad Magazine, or as teenage boys wanting to grab a hold of Playboy Magazine and sticking it under the bed, you know? I mean, that kind of stuff. So Age of Reason became this kind of bestseller in part because everyone else who was against it kept talking about it.
Well, unfortunately, we're out of time. Fortunately, there is the book is available. It's called Thomas Paine and the Promise of America. The author is Harvey J. Kay, and it's available through Hill and Wang. Thank you so much for being with us. But is there a website specifically for this, or should we just send them to Hill and Wang?
Well, there's Hill and Wang, and then, of course, there's the online booksellers, which are Amazon and Barnes & Noble, would probably be happy to receive their attention.
All right, and I will have a link on my site, peterwerby.com. Thanks so much for being a guest.
Thank you. It was a lot of fun.
1-800-325-2185. Call now. 1-800-325-2185. 1-800-325-2185.
Bill Bonds with a commercial. If you're near or farsighted and you want to throw away those glasses forever, I know a doctor you should see. Dr. Escombati. Phone number 1-877. Then the letters U-S-E-E-M-O-R-E. 1-877-UC-MORE. The equipment, the finest high-tech equipment ever made. Price $999 per eye. So don't fall for those $200 prices you hear being tossed around on the radio. Cows don't fly. Neither do those prices. Unless your daddy is an eye doctor and you're getting a freebie. Dr. S. Combati. No doctor we know of has a better success rate. Procedure is fast, safe. Cost $999 per eye. Virtually painless. You're in and out, maybe 40 minutes. Procedure itself, maybe 5. When it's over, you'll want to kiss your glasses goodbye and hug the doctor. Or maybe you guys will just want to give him a hi-fi, shake hands with him, walk away, and see a whole new world. See you.
Musky fishermen, get ready to compete for big money. The OSI Pro Series WRAF Great Lakes Fishing Championship Series is underway. There's still time to enter to win cash and prizes if you can boat the biggest fish on September 17th. Sign up now for the Musky Championship. Slots will fill up fast, so get your entry in today. Compete for thousands of dollars in cash and prizes, including the DMF Bait Award for the kid under 16 landing the largest fish on live bait. It's all going to be given away to the best fishing team in town, so sign up now by calling 248-591-6841 or go to WRIF.com for an entry form. There'll be fun for everyone at the post-event party at Hooters, so call 248-591-6841 to become the OSI Pro Series WRIF Great Lakes Fishing Series champion. Call 248-591-6841 today. Brought to you by OSI Pro Series, professional grade caulk, sealants, and adhesives. Complete battery source, every battery for every need, and 101 WRIF.
The party just doesn't stop. Tuesday nights with The Riff at Leopard's Lounge and Broil, Windsor's number one gentleman's club. Join 101 WRIF this and every Tuesday night for Riff Night at Leopard's Lounge and Broil. The Riff's Susie Cole will be there to party hard, and she'll have a ton of free Riff gear to give away, plus lots of other surprises. But you can't get them if you don't come out. Remember, guys, every week at Leopard's Lounge, they bring you new girls from all over the world, so it never gets boring. Plus, unlike other gentlemen's clubs, at Leopard's Lounge, you never pay a cover charge, ever. It's the best entertainment value around. Guys, you work hard. You deserve a night out. So make sure it's Riff Night with Susie Cole this Tuesday night at Leopard's Lounge and get ready to enjoy the finer things in life. Beer, free Riff stuff, and sexy, beautiful women. We'll see you at Leopard's Lounge in Windsor, just 5 minutes from the bridge or tunnel at 1190 Wyandotte West. Call 1-888-653-8881 for Leopard's Lounge and Broil. Transportation provided by Royal Limousine in Plymouth. Call 866-MY-ROYAL.
Now, Night Call is back on 101 WRIF Detroit. Here's your host, Peter Werby.
Thank you very much for joining me. A pleasure, as usual, to be with you. We've been doing a lot of fiction on this broadcast lately, and I always say it's tough because you don't want to give away the story. And this is an incredible story. The book simply has the initials D.B., D.B., it's a new novel by Elwood Reed. Elwood Reed has been on the Peter Werby Show before about his novel, If I Don't Six. You may remember that. It was when Elwood Reed, it's a novel, but it's a fictionalized account of football at the University of Michigan, where Elwood Reed played as well. Since then, he's published the novel Midnight Sun and also a collection of stories, What Salmon Know. And it's a pleasure to welcome back Elwood Reed to the Peter Werby Show. Hi, Elwood.
Hey, it's great to be back.
Yeah, right. This is quite a book. You know, I always, I'm not going to do it again because I've been saying it lately a lot. I always say it's tough to interview authors of novels because you don't want to give away anything. Yet I was looking at the Tuesday, August 17th review in the New York Times of your book, DB, and I'm thinking, man, are they going to tell the whole story here?
Hell, give it away. I don't care.
I'm not. I can't do it. Because this actually, I just read the whole book through before I got to this. But if I would have been unhappy had I read this ahead of time.
Well, that means I did my work then.
Yeah, you did. So. You did. It's a great book. Now here's the other thing. We're gonna kind of back into this story. DB is the first two initials of a Of a historical, I mean, I'm tripping over that because he's almost legendary, D.B. Cooper. Now, as one of the characters in the book does, I began going up to people and saying, do you know who D.B. Cooper was? And of the people around here at this radio station, only one person knew. So, D.B. Cooper, or could we... could we best explain who D.B. Cooper... No, I'll tell you what. Let's do it this way. I want you to read a little passage. But give us a synopsis and a reminder for the, and a new look at who D.B. Cooper is for those who have forgotten or who may not know.
Well, I'll just set up the little thing I'm going to read here. It starts out with a guy on an airplane, and he's on the airplane to hijack the airplane for money and then escape. And D.B. Cooper is not his real name. So I'm just going to read this small section, and then you and I can talk a little bit about, you know, there really is a D.B. Cooper.
Sure.
And I use the present tense, not past. This is from page 4. Before, the name he'd given at the ticket counter was Dan Cooper. It was not his real name, nor was it his first choice. He briefly toyed with Rip or Quint, but ruled them out as too memorable, settling finally on Dan Cooper, a name with just the right amount of generic menace. Dan Cooper sounded like the sort of guy who might hijack a plane the day before Thanksgiving, and Dan Cooper would have a bomb, and he would ask for money, and they would give it to him, because on this gray day, the man seated in seat 18C, calling himself Dan Cooper, did not give a damn if he lived or died. He was tired of mediocrity and the long, flat road that his life seemed to be speeding down, and he had arrived at this plan as a drowning man flails for a tow rope across riptide and chop. The plan was pure, a thing to hone and polish and stick to if deliverance was to be granted. And the minute he'd stepped onto the plane and seen the unoccupied back seat, he'd steeled himself for the worst that could happen, be it crash or cowardice on his part, that there'd be no future for him or anybody else in the plane, no Thanksgiving Day turkey, cream peas, oyster stew, or ginned-up relatives sleeping on the recliner, was of no consequence. Dan Cooper was getting the hell out. End of story, or maybe the beginning, depending on how things sorted.
Now, for most of us, D.B. Cooper, that was, in a way, the end, because I think we, without giving away anything of the novel or giving away as much as the New York Times review does, D.B. Cooper was given $200,000 by authorities. He had let the passengers go. The plane took off, and he took one of the parachutes he'd asked for, jumped out over the mountains of Washington, and gone from public view until DB by Elwood Reed.
Well, it's true. I mean, the day before Thanksgiving in 1971, I should mention, this guy just got on a plane, and he didn't even get up from his seat. He passed the stewardess, as they were called in those times, a note with his demands, saying he had a bomb in his briefcase and that he wanted $200,000, which at that time was a lot of money, and parachutes. And this was during a lot of social unrest. You know, there had been severe hijackings ending in, you know, death and hostage situations. And this guy, you know, just coolly asked for the money and the parachutes, and Northwest Airlines caved in and gave him the money and the parachutes, and he jumped out of the plane, was never heard from ever again. And, you know, that kind of got stuck in my head. And I was always fascinated with D.B. Cooper as a child. You know, it's a great way to, you know, start a novel because you're like, well, what the hell happened? You know, where did he go? What happened to him? Did he live? You know, and in my book, of course he lives. And I kind of wrote the book that I wanted, you know, I wanted to know what was going to happen to D.B. Cooper because you're right. The book starts with the ending. He jumps out.
Well, let's back up a little. Elwood Reed, you in 1971, you were how old?
Oh, boy. I'd be 6 or 7 years old.
Okay. Well, I asked someone here, and I said, did you ever hear of this? And they said, no. And I said, it was 1971. And she said, well, I was 1 year old.
Yeah, I know.
So how did...
Under 30, you're in trouble. Yeah, people don't remember him. He became a bit of a folk hero.
Yeah.
The Pacific Northwest, people wrote songs. They had T-shirts. And, you know, basically what was interesting about D.B. Cooper at the time was all the hijackers and skyjackers and people like that were political. They, you know, wanted people freed in Cuba, or they were Black Panthers, or they were for the Palestinians. D.B. Cooper had no political message whatsoever. He just asked for money and got out. And that's what's fascinating about him is, like, you know, who is this guy?
Mm-hmm.
He had no political agenda. That was interesting to me.
And is that the interest, getting out? Because that theme keeps coming.
Yeah, yeah. Well, and, you know, as little, you know, as a folk hero that he became a folk hero for sort of sticking it to the man. you know, at that time the concept of the man was a big thing. And so here's this guy who basically said, you know, forget America, forget, you know, working for a living. I'm going to take my money and disappear. You know, I'm getting out of this mess. You know, that was the initial fascination for me for D.B. Cooper.
Well, tell me a little more about your fascination, because say that you were 17, 10 years later, already this is the Reagan era, and certainly an extraordinarily large sea change in the kind of America we had.
Yeah.
And the admiration for rebels had dropped to around zero.
Exactly.
So how did you pick up on this D.B. Cooper story?
Well, you mean in the book or
No, in your life. I mean, because
well,
there had
I mean,
to be...
Because I remember talking about it when we were kids, and I remember it was a big deal. To me, in my neighborhood, it was a big deal.
Where'd you grow up?
In Cleveland, outside of Cleveland, Ohio.
Okay. All right.
And, you know, it was... You know, it was a thing where you looked around where you were from, and this is not the Cleveland of now. This is the Cleveland of, you know, the 1970s, which was, you know, losing sports teams, city on fire, all that, you know, river on fire. And this is a guy who got out of his life. And I think that's a fantasy that you have when you're a kid of getting out of your town or escaping. And I think it's certainly a fantasy that you get as you get older. You know, wouldn't it be great just to walk away from everything in your life with a lot of money?
Mm-hmm.
That became very alluring and seductive to me as a novelist. I probably sat in this novel for almost 10 years thinking about it. You know, I didn't know how to start it. I didn't know my way into the novel. I just knew there was something there. And, you know, finally the idea of this other FBI agent who tracks him fell out, and that's when I knew I had a novel.
All right, tell us about that. Introduce Frank Marshall as well.
The novel has, you know, D.B. Cooper, who, of course, is this kind of ne'er-do-well guy who comes back from the war, at least in my book, and he sees all the hippies and free love people around, and he wants to go out and get some free love and go down and, you know, and kind of join the counterculture. And so he thinks he needs money to do this, and that's why he does it. On the other hand, there's a guy named Frank Marshall, who's an FBI agent, who has basically what you'd call toed the line. He's, you know, stuck to his job, you know, been faithful to his wife. He's been a stand-up guy, and he's retiring as the novel starts. And he kind of begins to sympathize or empathize with D.B. Cooper. Here's a guy who's stuck to the rules his whole life, and where has it got him? That's sort of the dilemma that the Frank Marshall, the FBI character, faces as he chases down Cooper. And one of the cardinal sins of all, you know, sort of police work, they'll tell you, is you never sympathize with the criminals. You know, they're always the bad guys, you want to get them. And I said, well, what would happen if this guy spent his life looking and chasing for this guy, begins to realize, you know, what did I get for sticking, you know, to my life before, you know, by playing by the rules? What did I get out of this?
Hmm.
And the novel attempts to answer that.
Well, I'm sort of reminded, too, I don't know why this came to me, that you remember that Bob Seger song, Roll Me Away? Where,
oh, it's a great song, yeah.
Well, how much of that is in you? You were born in Cleveland. I know you were, last time we talked, I think you may have lived in Alaska, working as a carpenter. You live in rural Montana now.
Yeah.
Elwood Reed. I mean, I know most books aren't autobiographical, and I don't know enough about you as a person to suggest that there's a little bit of each guy in you.
Well, I mean, I think to write any kind of book, you have to find your way into the book, and I can understand both wanting to get out of my life and also sticking to the duty of my life, and so I was able to split myself into the book and say, you know, everybody has these fantasies. I'm not one of those kind of writers who can pitch himself or herself, you know, to a character I don't know anything about or pretend to know anything about. I had to understand D.B. Cooper and the FBI agent before I could write about them. And you mentioned Bob Seger. There's a Bob Seger lyric quote, one line in the book somewhere from Night Moves. You can find.
Oh, that's right. That's right. I had forgotten that. Elwood Reed is my guest on the Peter Werbe Show. R-E-I-D, if you're going to look that up. And the novel is D.B., D period, B period, talking about D.B. Cooper, the man who hijacked a plane in 1971, took $200,000 in cash, parachuted out over the Washington Monuments. I'm sorry, I'm thinking of Washington, D.C., aren't I? Washington
No.
Mountains.
Yeah.
And was never seen or heard from again, although he reappears in Elwood Reed's brand-new novel published by Doubleday. How much research did you have to do? There's so many points I thought, how does an author know this stuff? I mean, just beginning with D.B. Cooper, I'm sure there's a lot of literature about that.
Well, there's actually not much because, I mean, literally, again, a perfect reason to write a book is no one knew anything about this guy. This was back in the day when getting on an airplane was like getting on a bus. You walked on, you could smoke, you could carry handgun. I mean, no one, it was literally a very different time. The name he gave was a fake name. You just walked on, it was like getting a bus, you gave it any name you wanted, and you got on the plane. So no one knew anything about this guy. And as far as research goes, that gave me incredible creative license to lie, just to lie.
Well, I know the stewardess, right at the beginning, you say, took another look at the man, who's D.B. Cooper, sitting cool like Robert Mitchum under a haze of cigarette smoke sitting in the back of the plane.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Those days are over.
Well, I was even thinking, the parts that are set in Washington State, when you're talking about driving up highway this and down this road, were you actually there? Did you tread the turf that D.B. Cooper was supposed to have bailed out over?
Yeah, I took, what I actually did was me and a friend took a sort of substance-fueled road trip from Mexico up through the desert in Utah all the way up into the Pacific Northwest. It was basically an excuse to drive in a convertible, listen to music, and drink a lot, and that's what we did. And I got up there in that area, and I looked around. I know what the woods looks like, and you can look at a map. I'm not one of those kind of guys who's going to kill you with accurate details. And read nonfiction if you want to read that. I think there's a higher truth, which is you just sort of boil down a setting and an era, and you write just the essential parts of it.
Mm-hmm.
You don't go into high detail, or the story stalls out. And I did not want the story to stall out, because it is sort of a tricky story with flashbacks and stuff. I did not want, okay, here I'm going to tell you everything about the history of this highway we're driving on. It was just, I had to, fake it so the reader believes that, I know what I'm talking about, which is, couldn't be further from the truth.
But, it's interesting. There's a very exciting plot here. On the other hand, it's not, and I hope you don't take offense from this, it's not a page-turner in the sense that, for instance, Dan Brown's Da Vinci Code, or I just finished, I can't remember the guy's name, The Librarian, where every page they just escape by the skin of their teeth.
Yeah.
There's a lot of reflection. So it's a good story, and there's a lot of ideas.
Yeah, well, I knew I start out with him jumping out of a plane hoping to grab people by the throat, and then, the middle section of the book is what I really want to tell you, which is this story about, a guy and getting out of his life and a guy who chooses to stick in his life and, what does this mean? And I don't know about big themes. I mean, I'm from Cleveland. I kind of, those make me nervous to even talk about those things. But thank you for noticing that. That's something I worked hard at.
Well, we used to say, I don't know, it's probably the reverse is true now. We used to say that Cleveland is Detroit without the glitter. Although I think the opposite.
The opposite's true now.
It could be true. The other thing that struck me is, and I don't even want to, unlike this New York Times review, I don't want to give away any of it, but none of the characters are particularly admirable. I mean, when you read some of most detective fiction or thrillers or suspense novels, you can usually latch onto the character of the person being chased, but these are all pretty. All your characters are pretty mixed.
Well, they're complicated. I mean, one thing I dislike in fiction and movies and stuff like that I do not like characters who are perfect and sort of fall into tropes or cliches. I think people are complicated.
Yeah, and you would think. I guess what surprised me the most was the characterization of D.B. Cooper, who could be this character larger than life, this grand adventurer, and yet he's just kind of a working class guy that's trying to escape a humdrum life.
Well, I mean, part of coming to that came from the idea is that I thought, what kind of guy would get on an airplane, fake his way, obviously he probably didn't have a bomb, and in my book he fakes the bomb, and jump out of an airplane. It was cold, rainy, dark over this, vast Pacific Northwest, West woods, and he was very ill-equipped. He had a rain slicker and loafers. I mean, this is not a master criminal or a extremely brave guy. This is a guy who is desperate and hasn't thought it out that well.
Mm-hmm.
That's interesting to me.
Also, part of the book, well, switches different periods. You say flashbacks, but all comes together in, am I correct, in 1984?
Yes, yes.
Yeah, in 1984. Yes. And Cooper learns upon coming back to the United States that there's a D.B. Cooper Day celebrated in Washington. Is
there, there is, actually. There is, actually.
Did you ever attend that?
No, I went up to the bar where it's held, and it's sort of this little, like, you know, log wood bar that's up on this little tiny road, and their claim to fame is at the time that's where they thought D.B. Cooper had jumped out of the plane.
Mm-hmm.
Didn't end up being true. You know, they think the flight pattern was a little bit different. But every year, people go up there the day before Thanksgiving, they get drunk, some band plays, and people jump out of an airplane. And
still,
you know, it's just sort of, you know, hey, wouldn't it be great to get away? He's a hero in some ways. I thought, you know, what a great character for a book.
Yeah. And what do we know? Is there any speculation as to the fate of the real D.B. Cooper?
Well, I mean, we could be talking to him right now, right, Peter?
Yes.
Yeah.
No, you're too young.
No, so what I think is that he probably lived, maybe was injured. They did find about $6,000. About 10 or 13 years, I can't think of 13 years after he jumped, they found money buried in a sandbank. Some kid dug it up. It was all together. Now, $200,000 is a hell of a lot of money, very heavy.
Mm-hmm.
I theorize that either he got injured and had to leave some behind, couldn't drag it out, or he left some to come back for it. But you got to remember that at the time, this was the largest FBI manhunt around. I mean, it was huge. They were combing the woods, they had National Guard out, helicopters, everything. And I also come from the school of thought that if he had died, say, on the jump, like a lot of the FBI guys think he might have, somewhere, somebody would have found something. The parachute, his shoes, clothing, bones. I mean, these are woods that hunters are all over. And, you know, every year the people find things in the woods. They never found a single scrap of him ever. And had he died on impact, you would have found that.
I wonder if he would read your book if he's still alive.
He could be out there. We could be talking. You know, we should put a shout out to him. I'll buy him a drink. it's funny because I was in I gave a reading in Portland, and this woman came up to me. I was in Seattle actually, and she said she knew D.B. Cooper, and she had these pictures of this guy. You know, and I didn't look that much like him, but she was very convinced, and she wouldn't tell me her name. She wouldn't tell me his name. She said he was not doing very well, but he wants the truth to be out there. And I'm like, okay. She didn't buy a book either.
The book is D.B., D period, B period, for D.B. Cooper, the man that in 1971 jumped out of an airliner with $200,000 in ransom money and is now a fictionalized account by my guest, Elwood Reed, on the Peter Werby Show. One more theme, and then I'd like to ask you a couple other questions about the future. Manliness, that's always been a theme through a lot of your books, certainly reflecting on your experience as a University of Michigan football player, and if I don't six. And I'll have to say, I didn't read Midnight Sun because we don't want to get into this on the air. How your publicist didn't send it to me. But don't.
We can get into it in the air.
We don't want to go there. We've got only about 5 minutes left. Tell me about manliness in Elwood Reed's books.
Well, I think it's, I mean, for me, it's certainly a theme that I'm interested in. And I'm not, I mean, in manliness, I don't mean the sort of Hemingway code. I kind of like to, you know, poke a pin in all that, and it irritates me in some respects that my prose is always, you know, you write one football book, you're a football author the rest of your life.
Sure.
The people attach certain, you know, ideas about, you know, the kind of writing it's in that. Muscular is one, athletic is always a verb they use or an adjective they use to describe my writing. It's just something I think it's what defines, I mean, it's what I know best, obviously, but it's how you define that sense of manliness or worth versus what you do every day.
Mm-hmm.
And that's, to me, is the great struggle for most people. Manliness, I don't mean that in a gender-specific way. I think there's women in the book who are struggling to define themselves, too, against, you know, these sort of stereotypes. And so that's interesting to me. It's always been fascinating to me is how people sort of put up these fronts, and they couldn't be further from the truth. And in this case, you've got a guy named D.B. Cooper who people take as this sort of swaggering cowboy, and the truth is probably that he was a very desperate, scared guy who had to get out of his life for some reason.
Right. But there's kind of being a manly man is a heavy load.
That's
a lot to carry. All right, let me see. Ooh, we just got a few minutes left. The future. This book, of course, I always think that with every book I read, this is a Hollywood movie written all over it, except with most of the ideas taken out, right?
Yeah, exactly. Not yet, no. There's been a few people who've, you know, been interested, but no. And, you know, you can never guess. I mean, my first book, which was a plotless coming-of-age book set in college football, was optioned 3 or 4 times for the movies. My last book, which was, you'd think would be a movie instantly, was no one even saw the book. So you never know. It takes the right person to kind of find, you know, that theme out there. It's interesting to me that, you know, Chuck Palahniuk is another sort of, you know, writer that I think, you know, is kind of similar to what I do. You know, his book Fight Club made into a movie, but it couldn't be further from really what he's trying to do in his fiction. And, you know, you get mistranslated and misinterpreted, and it's always a miracle when a movie like that does find its way to the screen. So I don't hold out much hope. I mean, look, I wrote the book I wanted to write. It's perfect as far as I'm concerned, or at least, you know, as far as I could get it. And what happens after that is, you know, anybody else's business.
Well, would that be a concern to you? Because I said that with a laugh, that it would be the plot but without the ideas, and that's exactly what I would imagine it would be. Would that be acceptable?
Well, yeah, see, that's why I brought up Chuck Palahniuk. I mean, he wrote a book called Fight Club.
Sure.
And the first half of that movie, there's a lot of these ideas about, you know, about manhood and all of the ideas that his fiction is full of. They got on the screen, but then it divulges into sort of a, you know, kind of a crass Hollywood comedy kind of thing. You know, I don't have any expectations. If it makes 3 people go and buy the book after they see the movie, it's a success in my book. I'm completely happy to have anybody enjoy it however they want.
And you're doing screenwriting in Hollywood?
Yes.
What type?
I'm writing for television.
Yeah, and is that
the new Stephen? There's a Stephen Bosco, the creator of NYPD Blue,
mm-hmm.
and Hill Street Blues, and L.A. Law. I'm working on a new show that will debut in the spring.
Now, I shouldn't, I hope this isn't too personal, but someone told me that you drive between Montana and Hollywood.
Yeah.
Not fear of flying.
No, I fly to, as a matter of fact, I'll be on a plane today. So
that's good.
Yeah, I need to escape Los, I am not a fan of Los Angeles, to tell you the truth.
Yeah.
I need to get on a plane. I haven't asked for, you know, money and parachutes yet, but we'll see.
Well, the question, I mean, why I think that this, and, you know, I predict right here, maybe just because I just finished the book, DB, that this could hit the right note at the right time. I mean, plane hijacking ain't what it used to be. I mean, in other words...
I was writing this book before, of course, we all know what happened September 11th. I was writing, and I was like, oh, my God, what the heck am I doing?
Have you had any negative feedback on that? Hey, why are you lionizing? Which you're not necessarily, but
no, because I think the whole book redeems it, and it's, you know, I take great pains to set this guy up as a guy who does not like violence. You know, this guy is a victim of violence in the book, D.B. Cooper. He ends up, not to give away what happens, but he ends up, something very bad befalls him in his search for you know, free love and counterculture, and forces him to come back to the United States.
Mm-hmm.
You know, after all these years, and try to recover some of his money.
Although that's all told in the New York Times review.
Exactly.
We're not going to tell it here. There's only one way to find out all of this, folks. A wonderful read. It's DB, D period, B period, for DB Cooper, the man who hijacked $200,000 and bailed out 33 years ago over the mountains of Washington. Yeah. Now the story can be told. It's in Elwood Reed's new novel. And I highly recommend it. Elwood Reed, thanks for joining me on the Peter Werby Show.
Thank you, Peter.
Yeah, 50.
Give me 50. And then call Rock Financial, home of the mortgage experts, at 800-333-ROCK or see them online at rockfinancial.com. Rock Financial, Quicken Loans Company, Equal Housing Lender.
Yeah, Equal Housing Lender.
Equal is a big word here.
Yes, I got it.
Call today, 800-333-ROCK.
Home of the mortgage experts.
Homeowners, are you behind on bills, deep in debt, tired of hearing no from other lenders? Call American Equity Mortgage at 888-229-7699 and hear yes instead.
As a loan officer at American Equity Mortgage, saying yes is a big part of my job, even to people with less than perfect credit.
American Equity Mortgage makes yes simple and fast. You can apply on the phone, in person, or at AmericanEquity.com. Get approval in hours and close as fast as 1 week. American Equity Mortgage wants you to have the money you need right now. We can help you pay off those high-interest credit cards and save you hundreds of dollars every month. It's easy. Just say yes to American Equity Mortgage. Toll free, 888-229-7699, and we'll say yes to you. American Equity Mortgage, open till 8, 888-229-7699, or apply online at AmericanEquity.com.
It's party time. Get a real feel of erotic image featuring Michigan's hottest male and female strippers.
Erotic image.
Add a stripper to any party and watch your party come alive.
Erotic Image Strippers delivers the sexiest and most seductive entertainers right to your doorstep.
For your next bachelor, bachelorette, birthday, or any party occasion, give the gift that unwraps itself. Call Erotic Image Strippers at 888-41-STRIP.
Explore Erotic Image at eroticimage.com, the official home of the Erotic Image Dream Girls, the incredible hunks of Men in Motion, and those naughty, awesome twosomes, the wild girly girls. Turn your party into a bash and try a party appetizer to kick off your next gathering. Their costumed host, hostess, and bartenders will cater to your guest of honor and dazzle your party. Now at Erotic Image, male and female models for any and all events.
Call, click, or visit the Erotic Image Cyber Showcase. View Erotic Image's strippers, check their prices, and place your order online.
Call Erotic Image at 888-41-STRIP. That's 888-41-STRIP.
Erotic Image, where image is everything.
Every successful career has a beginning. Have you started yours yet? Turbocharge your opportunities by calling ITT Technical Institutes at 1-800-903-1919. Nationwide, thousands have launched technical careers after graduating from an ITT Tech. If you have an interest in electronics, information technology, or drafting and design, they teach skills that many employers look for. Most programs provide a hands-on education and can help you build your knowledge base and technical skills. Classes meet just a few times a week to help you balance school and your job. Financial aid is available for those who qualify, and career assistance is available once you graduate. Develop technical skills at an ITT Tech and discover a whole new world of opportunity. Call now for a brochure at 1-800-903-1919. That's ITT Tech, 1-800-903-1919. 1-800-903-1919.
101 WRIF Detroit.
Yeah.